Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Pretner Solon, Senate File 2069.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is an attempt to solve an ongoing dispute between the City of Duluth and the Duluth Seaway Port Authority regarding the Port Authority levy. Statute currently requires that the City of Duluth approve the Seaway Port's levy. Under current law, the City has no authority to adjust or reject the port's levy. It is a mandatory levy. Over the past several years, the Duluth City Council has expressed a lot of displeasure over being required to vote on and approve something that they have no authority to change or adjust. In fact, in the past couple of years, the City Council has voted both to reduce the Seaway Port's levy and last year voted to reject the port's levy. This bill would relieve the city of this situation by taking the city out of the process altogether. And the mayor of Duluth does support this initiative because it really removes a headache for the city. And as you will hear from Adolf Ojar, the executive director of the Seaway Port, the port is an independent entity whose board is appointed by the governor, St. Louis County, and the city of Duluth. For the parties involved, it is time to put this issue to rest. The best way to do this is to affirm the port's independence by treating them like other special taxing districts rather than going through this exercise where the city must vote on something over which they have no power. And there is a note here showing it has no fiscal impact. So I would like to turn it over, Mr. Chair, to Adolf Ojard, who is the executive director of the Seaway Port.
Mr. Ojard?
Ojard, yes.
Welcome
Thank
to the
you.
Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, as stated, my name is Adolf Ojard. I am the executive director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. The Seaway was created by the state of Minnesota, and the Seaway's seven commissioners are appointed, two by the governor, two by St. Louis County, and three by the city of Duluth. None of the appointing bodies has a controlling majority. Creating the Seaway in such a manner reflects the legislative judgment on the degree to which various controls are necessary and reflects the legislative judgment that the Seaway is a vital, independent, statewide asset. The Port Authority is actively involved in maritime commerce and economic development within the city of Duluth and throughout the region in the state. The Seaway terminal operations rank number in the top five in the country for handling wind turbine components. In the area of economic development, the Seaway is currently working with the United States Steel in an attempt to clean up and redevelop the largest and one of the oldest Superfund sites in the state. The Seaway has worked closely with MPCA to develop responsible and comprehensive ballast water permitting bills that have really become a standard for the Great Lakes states. We are also instrumental in beginning the Great Ships Initiative, which is a research facility located in the Duluth Harbor dedicated to finding solutions that will stop invasive species from traveling in ballast water. In 1984, the City of Duluth and the Seaway entered into a contract which is still in effect. The contract gave the city the fees from issuing industrial revenue bonds, which the city used to fund its newly created business development department. These fees were formerly revenue to the Seaway. The contract also reads, and I'll quote, to provide for economic viability and long-term financial stability of the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth, both the City of Duluth and the Seaway will seek legislative approval for a special levy to assist on ongoing maritime operations. Under the contract, the City and the Seaway were successful in obtaining legislative approval of 469.053 subsection 4, which remains the current in-place statute. The statute reads, and I quote again, a city shall, at the request of the Port Authority, levy a tax in any year for the benefit of the Port Authority. The operative words are a city shall. And just as with all other special taxing districts, the legislation caps the levy request. In the Seaway's case, the cap is 0.01813% of taxable market value. In 2005, the City Council tried to change the Seaway's levy request, resulting in the City and the Seaway going to binding arbitration to determine if the levy was mandatory or discretionary on the part of the City. The arbitrator's opinion is that the levy is mandatory and that the City cannot change the Seaway's levy. The arbitrator's reasoning in the law says the levy is mandatory on the part of the city, and being mandatory, the levy allows the Seaway to enter into long-term development and redevelopment agreements to issue bonds with a degree of certainty of not defaulting on the bond agreements and other obligations. This tax levy is the only levy controlled by the Seaway. In 2008, the City Council voted to reject the Seaway levy request in its entirety, which reduced the levy to zero. The St. Louis County Attorney's Office reacted to the City Council action through a letter, and the letter states, and I will quote again, "As I believe you know, the levy request by the Port Authority is mandatory and perhaps should not even go to the Council for resolution. In response to the letter and other initiatives, the Seaway's levy request was reinstated. As you can see, the current arrangement is unsatisfactory for both the City Council and for the Seaway. This bill clarifies the Seaway's special taxing district status and allows the Seaway to levy independently, which in effect it already does. It relieves the City Council of voting to relieves the City Council of having to vote on a levy it cannot control. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens when the city votes to not do the levy? I mean, I don't get the process. I mean, what happens if they vote to not do it?
There was a change in heart, and the levy then was administratively progressed.
Mr. Chair, it's more of a power ploy. They can't. It's legally they can't. They only have the right to accept the budget and the levy. They don't have any right to reject it or adjust it. And so I don't know if they legally could have even imposed this, so it went to the taxpayers in that way. But they ended up having to go to arbitration to resolve it. And as I said, the mayor does support this legislation because it does relieve a headache for the city.
Any other questions, members? Chair Lee is over Senate File 2069 for inclusion in the committee's bill. Thank you, Senator Solon. Mr. Oldred, thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's next? Senator Saltzman. Members, Senate File 292, we don't actually have in our possession. Passed out, where was it yesterday, Senator Saltzman? Finance?
In Finance, Mr. Chair.
The Finance Committee yesterday passed out of there. The committee report will go to the floor this morning at session, and the bill is then coming to us. So after the floor session today, we'll actually have the bill in our possession. But, and there was a, was there any amendments to it in the Finance Committee?
No, there's not, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Saltzman, why don't you tell us about Senate File 292. And we did have this bill, members, last year in the committee. We heard it in the Jobs Committee. I believe we heard it here. I was actually the author of it last year. So Senator Saltzman is the author. But this year I did not disc it because I didn't think it was a good idea. It was just looking at the whole budget situation and having some understanding of what I was going to be facing this session. I thought Senator Saltzman could do a better job moving this bill through the process than and had more time to do that than I probably did. So Senator Saltzman, thank you for carrying the bill, and let's hear about it.
There, and thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And you're absolutely right. This is a bill that, as we have committees in this building right now talking about cutting programs, we absolutely have to, in this session, bring together a package of proposals that allows us to grow jobs and grow our way out of this economic crisis. And Senate File 292, which you're hearing now, and the bill after this, is really a package of bills that's going to help address some of the lack of capital that we have in this state for some of our most promising and also emerging high-tech companies. We all know the global economy, you know, is really creating a challenge for us. And in Minnesota right now, we are underperforming the rest of the nation. And this is the first instance of that happening. Now, in your packets, I believe you have a handout And this handout really talks about and shows the whole commercialization process. We've done great work in this legislature to promote our research capacity with our research universities. We have all these wonderful ideas coming out of our state. We have done great things in that area, but what happens is that if we don't have the capital that's going to advance those emerging ideas from, you know, the lab bench to the marketplace, those ideas are going to be plucked out of our state and taken elsewhere. And that's really the situation right now. We are already hearing about emerging companies in Minnesota that are going over across the river to Hudson because they have some of these programs in place. So what can we do in terms of having this very needed capital available? So with me today is Mr. Korngold and Mr. Brennan and also Mr. Lipschultz, who are going to give you a better idea of this program. I know Senator Rosen had a similar proposal before you yesterday, and this particular bill really expands on that because as we hear what's happening in other states, and they are competing with us, they are taking what we have homegrown in Minnesota. And they're looking at, taking those ideas and those emerging companies and then creating jobs in other states. So we've made the key investments, but we need to be able to have the rest of the program in place. Now, what's important to note, too, with Senate File 292, which really works with our insurance industry in creating these funds, is that these funds could be invested elsewhere. So it's really an incentive program to keep these dollars in Minnesota and put them to work. It's also a program where we're going to be able to put the money to work for 4 years before we actually have to pay out the tax credit. So I really appreciate, Senator Bach, that you have have given me the opportunity to carry this bill because it's been very exciting because I think in this economic climate that we're in, being able to grow jobs and create the new economy in Minnesota is very, very important. So with that, Mr. Korngold, do you like to start?
Okay. Senators, I'm Michael Korngold, the president of Enhanced Capital Partners. I thought I would just touch on briefly the mechanics of the program and the process by which this capital is raised and then ultimately and most importantly deployed into small businesses within the state. This is a program that's really founded on a free market approach to solving the capital needs of small businesses in the state. And one of the reasons it's been so successful in other states, and I think you'll hear more detail about that in a bit, is because it has taken the state out of the role of picking winners and losers in terms of the businesses that receive capital and even the fund managers that make the investments. And it really relies on a free market approach to that, again, as Senator Saltzman said, using a tax credit to do so. The mechanics are simple. After the program is implemented, private firms like ours, a competitive firm is also here, represented by Mr. Brennan. There are several others, typically six up to 10 private firms will apply and be certified according to objective criteria set forth in the statute. Once certified, firms go out and try to raise money on a pure free market basis from insurance companies, as you've heard. And those insurance companies are receiving a very long-term tax credit that begins in 2013 and is then incremental thereafter. The insurance companies choose if they decide to participate which of the firms they're going to invest with. Many insurance companies choose not to participate in the program, and obviously, based on the history of the program, several do. At that point, the capital is raised from those insurance companies. The benefit of the program is that 100% of that money is raised up front, is available for small businesses day one. But as you've heard, the tax credit doesn't hit the budget until 2013 and then incrementally thereafter. Following the fundraising, each of our firms has an office here, local professionals on the ground, finding businesses, making the investments throughout the state. And that takes place sometimes in a collaborative process from firm to firm, but we're all looking at different sectors. We all have different expertise areas and geographically as well. And the last point I think I would make is that unlike conventional funds, these investment firms that participate in this program can take no profits from any of these investments until 100% of the capital is deployed into small businesses in the state of Minnesota. And that's a key difference. It's one of the reasons why it's a very, very different model from, say, a conventional venture capital model.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Lipschultz. I am one of the co-founders of a local firm called Eagle Street Partners. Eagle Street was set up 2 years ago specifically for the purpose of investing in small businesses in the upper Midwest. And we did that because we surveyed the territory, and based on our experiences throughout the country, for me most recently in Silicon Valley, we determined that upper Midwestern small businesses have a very limited access to capital. And this is based not only on what we see, but for me, as a St. Paul native, growing up and seeing and experiencing small businesses, private enterprise, entrepreneurship, and community banking throughout the state, knowing that all of those parties have to come together to support what we believe to be the backbone of employment in this part of the country. And it's an important part. When our firm was put together, we know that we ultimately collaborate with other sources of capital. Banks, very important. Early stage, venture, angel investors, all of these parties come together to support small businesses. Our piece specifically steps in where banks can't participate on a unique basis. If I'm a manufacturer in New London, Minnesota, and I want to expand my plant and hire more people, and I need $750,000, and I apply to a local bank, they're going to ask me for collateral, rightfully so, probably in excess of $1 million. Now, if I happen to have $1 million sitting around in unpledged collateral, I'm in good shape. Most businesses don't have that. We are equity players. We want to move equity into the balance sheets of these companies and accelerate growth. We want to hire people. We want to expand plant and equipment. We want to buy things. We want this region of the country to prosper. Now, at present, Eagle Street Partners has a mandate to focus throughout the upper Midwest. And because we, like many of the companies that we pursue, have a for-profit motive, we will seek the opportunities where they exist. That may take me to Chicago. That may take me to Dakotas and Wisconsin. But we love working here in Minnesota. We're headquartered here in Minnesota. We want the state and we want participants alongside us to help bring more capital to bear so that we can put it to work. That's what we do for a living. We're not capital raisers, we're capital deployers. We like this geography. We like to work fast. We were very interested when we were approached by the participants in response to this bill that there is a time commitment here. Move the money into the business. Move the money out into the state immediately. Don't take. Give. Put it to work fast. Venture firms like ours, tend to work very methodically, very analytically. That's fine. We have to do good work. We have to be smart. We have to pay attention. But there's every reason to believe there is an overwhelming number of opportunities. I know it because I do it every day of the year. Throughout the state, throughout the region, there are companies that need this capital. And it is important that we step up and we provide this capital to the country. And if we do that, we will grow jobs, we will grow businesses, we will grow this part and grow Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners. And I thought I might close perhaps with sharing some experience from other states that have similar programs. I think a benefit of the legislation you have in front of you is that it is not an experiment. There is a track record of over 10 years from other states. Interestingly, the bill you have in front of you, though, I think is the most evolved program of its kind across the country. The lowest tax credit of the programs that other states have, most aggressive schedule for investing of the other states have, and more oversight than any of the other states have. I think I'll start with Wisconsin, who implemented a $50 million program in 1999. And as recently, the state has come in to say that they have experienced new tax revenues, new general fund revenues of $91 million for their $50 million program. 35% of all of those investments have been in life sciences and biotechnology. State of Missouri has three programs that total $130 million. For every dollar invested through their program, approximately $13 from out-of-state money have come into Missouri small businesses. Those businesses have created or retained 3,100 jobs. Governor Bob Holden, who was treasurer when two of those three programs were implemented, and then governor as the programs were overseen, has said, now that we're looking at the program a dozen years out, we continue to see it's a great success for our state. The Missouri Capital Program has generated more than $112 million of capital investment in Missouri small businesses. And lastly, Texas. Texas has nine participating firms across their state, two programs totaling $400 million. In the first 12 months, $52 million was invested in 37 different Texas small companies. The bill that you have before you, I think, even has greater safeguards for the state of Minnesota, better targeting, and an even more aggressive schedule. And we'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator Saltzman, I'm looking at, on page 2, the qualified businesses on line
219,
line 2.22. There's in A through G, there's a number of types of businesses that are excluded from participating in the program. Has there been any discussion? Is that list extensive enough? Is there anything else that we should have on that list? Has there been any discussion about that?
Perhaps I'll ask our testifiers to perhaps discuss that. Mr. Brennan, you look like you're ready to address that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know there's been specific discussion. That list has really been developed, frankly, over time as people have tried to articulate slower growing or perhaps temporary job businesses. We'd be very happy to have that conversation to make sure it's targeted in a way that you'd like.
Mr. Brennan, what in the other states is the list of prohibited businesses, is it any different than this? I mean, have they got a larger list that they've developed over time? Or?
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chair, this is a list that's consistent with the other states. It actually is more expansive than some early states. And, again, it's really designed to exclude business areas that, frankly, are not as subject to the current economic cycle that we're in, don't need to rely on a subsidized program like this for their development.
It doesn't specifically exempt retail. I'm wondering why not. Why would we allow this kind of a business incentive to be used for a retail business, or is that in here somewhere?
It doesn't exclude retail. It certainly could. Keeping in mind that these businesses all have to be headquartered here, fewer than 100 employees. So it would not be eligible, say, to invest in a retail chain where simply a local store was part of a national chain. That would be excluded because it would be too many employees and it wouldn't be located in the state. And so in other states, there have been successful retail investments where it's been a startup concept. Somebody has brought to market for the first time a retail concept that then has grown into a significant business.
Well, Mr. Korngold, I can just tell you I'm not too interested in making public investments in retail. I mean, if there's a market for retail, it will get built. It will serve the needs of the community, and people will come and shop there, and it will work. It will cash flow. But using state money to subsidize development of retail businesses that in many cases are going to be in competition with other businesses in the community or neighboring communities, I find pretty problematic. And when we worked on the Job Z issue with the governor, there was specifically a retail exemption that, frankly, I insisted on for that very reason. So if there's not an exemption somewhere else, I'd like to be able to consider a retail prohibition from retail businesses participating.
If I could, Mr. Chair, certainly on behalf of the industry, I don't think you would have any resistance on that from us. And if you look at our portfolios in other states, we'd have to look to see if retail businesses had been funded. If so, few and far between. The only thing, because I think this issue did come up in another state, that we would caution is to make sure that the way that retail, the definition of retail is crafted, is that it would not prohibit internet-based businesses and high technology businesses that may have some aspect of their business selling services using the internet, that they would get caught up in that, because that's some of the most promising businesses that we have funded.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in hearing what kind of business. I mean, I understand the high tech, but you said you think that this has been used for some retail. Do you have any idea, Mr. Korngold, of what? I just need an example.
Sure. So we have a very successful business that we helped start through the New York version of this program. And what they did, and it has a local tie-in because they partnered actually with Best Buy, what they did is they created a replacement parts solution because that was a real problem for Best Buy, who bought an expensive television set and then a very insignificant part broke. So they have created a huge online database. It's now, you know, significantly larger than Radio Shack's, and they sell both directly to businesses and they can sell directly to consumers. They do have an online presence. Their core business, though, is working with Best Buy and other retailers like that. Terrific technology-based business. When we invested, they were 10 employees. They now have over 200 employees. It's really been a phenomenal growth story. No one would look at them and say, gee, that's a retail business because it's a pure technology business. But because a portion excuse me, of their business could be defined as retail, we would just be concerned if the definition of retail was so expansive that a business like that, for example, couldn't be funded.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I would share that concern. I don't want to rule something out just because it is retail, because, I mean, there's retail and then there's retail. You know, it's something that's highly specialized, very technical in nature, and...
Mr. Korngold, we'll put some kind of a retail prohibition in here, but I guess I pledge to you, we'll work with you when we get into conference committee. We make sure that it doesn't unintendedly do something, prohibit something that we might otherwise want to happen. So if there's something in here and the language isn't quite right, it's not that we don't want to get it right. It's just that we're kind of pinched for time here, and our Senate counsel is pretty busy as it relates to drafting the bill. So if we don't quite get it right, don't think we don't care.
I appreciate that, Mr.
Chair. And Senator, I might add, we'd be thrilled to work with anyone on that language. And I think your aim is spot on. I think why a lot of these industries were really discussed in the first part is we want to make sure that these companies can go from 3 employees to 300 or to 3,000. Retail often doesn't make that type of a leap. So for this program to pay back to the state, which all of us want, it's got to be able to make that large leap. So we'd be thrilled to work with you on that language.
I hate to speak for everybody of the committee, but we had quite a jobs discussion here yesterday, and I think it's fair to say all the members of this committee are real concerned about this tax bill doing something to create some incentives for economic development. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think the 60% is too low. 60% of the employees have to be in the state. I think that's too low.
60%.
Because if it's a small company, it's only got 20 employees. You know, it's kind of like...
Mr. Korngold, how does that compare to what this program looks like in other states?
60% of employees.
Right. Each state has taken a different approach to qualified businesses. Some have a headquarters requirement but actually don't focus on a percentage of employees. The center's concern, we've seen that number go up to 80%, and if I could speak at least on behalf of the industry or our firm, we certainly would have no objection to that.
Does the project work at that, at 80?
It does.
Is it working in other states at 80?
It does. I mean, obviously, what happens, Mr. Chair, is that the more restrictive that you make it, sometimes you have businesses that look like, gee, this is the perfect business located in Minnesota, been headquartered here for a long time, now needs to grow. But because maybe they have an office in, you know, Arizona, they're going to be ineligible for funding. Without making it too complicated, one way that some other states have dealt with that is they sometimes will put in a provision that if a business does not meet those qualifications, then the department can actually issue a waiver. We're less crazy about that because you get into kind of a strange dynamic sometimes. We like it to be very black and white so everyone knows exactly what qualifies. But they do have 80% in other states, and I would say that it has worked.
Mr. Korngold, the commissioner over the Department of Economic Development hasn't been confirmed by the Senate yet, so we share your reluctance to add additional discretion to his authority. Senator Saltzman, anything further?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that just to state that we have really brought together a broad group of stakeholders. We have the support of the High Tech Association. We have worked with Life Science Alley. We've worked with so many people. We've worked with the governor's office, the administration, to really come together around a bill. And this is larger than the governor's proposal because we think that we need to think big in terms of economic development. The need is there. We hear repeatedly from people who love Minnesota and who have created ideas, have worked for different companies here. They want to stay here as they create these new companies, but right now they're being forced to leave. So having something like this is extremely important as we look at growing our way out of this economic crisis. So I truly appreciate your support. The Senate has been historically supportive of this concept, so we have some work to do as we move this forward. But I very much believe that this is something that we have to look at in terms of our economic recovery.
Senator Saltzman, we're probably going to have some late nights in this room over the next month. And you realize if we put this in the bill, you're going to be subjected to that because the House tax chair has been very reluctant to go down the tax credit road. So I think we have quite a bit of work to do over the next month if we're going to incorporate this to have her see the light. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Saltzman, I just came in and missed the beginning of your presentation. You had just said that these corporations are looking for this type of tool. Otherwise, they have to leave the state. Could you tell me what are the reasons why they have to leave the state?
Well, I will give you an example, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, examples of what I have heard from people in my own community, people who are my constituents, in terms of leaving the state, that if you have an emerging company and you have an idea, you have to go through. There was a handout here that really talks about the early stage business and what we call the valley of death, that we have great promise in this state in terms of emerging ideas, but then it's getting the capital to advance. Sometimes it's a federal grant. We've talked some of that within our business committee about how we use federal grants to advance projects, how we look at, you know, families and friends, angel investors, and this is really the early stage venture capital. And right now there isn't a lot of capital in Minnesota, but when you look at other states and they have incentive programs that include tax credits to really incentivize people making those investments, taking that risk, those dollars and those programs are in other states. And so as these companies go and look for, sort of shop around to see who will invest in this idea, they're finding people with the cash that have these incentive programs on the East and West Coast and right across the St. Croix River. And I have constituents who have had very promising ideas, have tried to raise capital in Minnesota, and have relocated in Hudson. They live in my district, but they have their business now in Wisconsin because that's where the programs are that give them the needed capital to advance their idea. And when I drive to the Capitol, I see a lot of people from Wisconsin crossing on 94. We'd like to keep jobs here instead of sending them the opposite way. So we have the potential here. We're still known as, we have these ideas, and people are coming in here and plucking them out and saying, here's where the cash is, or we'll invest in your company, But as it becomes successful, I want you in my backyard. And so these companies are then relocating. So in terms of, we're not forcing them to leave, but in order for them to grow and see success, they're going where the money is. And there's this incentive to, you know, and it's a tax credit. Because we're asking people to really, you know, to take a risk with these companies. Not all of them survive. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an incentive program that we're seeing other states, you know, really compete with us.
All right.
I hope, does that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Salzman, I'm hearing the perspective that they're being, corporations in Minnesota are being pulled away from Minnesota due to a failure of having adequate capital opportunities to expand. Part of that may be the lack of credit availability nationwide and the restrictions that are now here that weren't here as of a few years ago. Was there any discussion on the part of these corporations of other issues that may have, instead of pulled them out of Minnesota, have pushed them out of Minnesota, such as our tax rates on corporate property income tax or corporate and industrial property taxes, corporate income taxes, and that type of policy that we have in the state of Minnesota?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I'd like to have Mr. Lipschultz answer that question since he's on the front line of this issue.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. What we find on the front line, as it were, is a range of situations going on. But one scenario is exactly what the Senator has outlined. Businesses being pulled away, pushed away due to lack of capital and this emergence through this valley of death. But there is a complement to that and a very interesting and challenging one, which is companies that are seeking to grow will have to either make the decision to seek capital elsewhere to grow these ideas or to not grow. And that is as challenging to them as pushing them out of state. If I'm a company with 30 employees and I want to grow a line of business and get up to 50, 70, 80, and I can't attract and I can't find the capital, I just may not grow. And that's the equivalent to losing 30, 40 jobs. So we really look at many, many scenarios out there, and it is not always just the all or nothing binary solution, either a business is or a business isn't. It's but what can they become? What could they grow to become with our help and with our assistance? And the more we have access to equity capital, we, professional investment managers, and they, the companies that have the vision and the ideas, the more we can support these growth of jobs. And that's really what we do.
Mr. Lipschultz, if I was a business going to access this, and I realize you have to offer some kind of a competitive interest rate, otherwise you're never going to access the credit because the money's never going to go out the door. But what kind of an interest rate could a business expect relative to maybe the prime lending rate?
Well,
and it varies, I understand.
Absolutely, yeah. Kind of a difficult question to ask because it depends on the type of investment, the amount of investment. But at least at my firm, Eagle Street Partners, our primary investment vehicle is actually equity. So it is not an interest rate driven. It is not the payment of annual interest on the investment. It's taking an ownership stake in the company. So our interest is absolutely aligned with our fellow owners, who may be the existing entrepreneurs and visionaries, and trying to obtain the same returns that they obtain. Now, I do know that through the various programs that are run here, there's certainly a range of other forms of capital that would involve interest that may be somewhat benchmarked against prime. But again, the only thing I can speak to with much expertise is really those equity investments. And that's what we're trying to do, not extract annual rates of return, but extract and build rates of return over time for all of our investors.
Anybody else want to take a shot at that?
From our firm's vantage point, we're covering exactly as Mr. Lipschultz said, both the equity side, but in some cases we'll encounter businesses, they don't want to give up any equity. Right. They need the capital to expand, but you know they own 100% of their business, always have, and that's the way they want to keep it. And in those cases, then We do offer a debt solution. It's never going to be competitive with a bank because, again, if these businesses can get money from a bank, they're always going to do that, 10 times out of 10. These are the businesses that can't borrow money from a bank. And so it's not always priced off prime, but it's a market rate. And one of the things that sort of keeps, the program pricing honest is that if they didn't like our pricing, they know they qualify already because we qualify them. They're just going to knock on Mr. Brennan's firm's door and say, hey, these guys are too high. What can you guys do for me?
Senator, I thought I might add lastly that if you look across some of these other states, you'll see 75 to 80% of all investments are equity type investments. And again, I think our research shows that's where the state can get its biggest bang for the buck because that's that catalytic capital. And our hope is once a company gets beyond that valley of death, they can access, frankly, cheaper and more conventional financing and that they might either want to buy us out or we can become long-term partners. And lastly, when we invest in a company, that equity isn't a dollar in and then you walk away. It's a dollar in, and then we often take a seat on the board of directors at the company's request. We help them recruit additional employees, help them find sales channels. So the equity really has a lot of benefits, I think, from a state economic development perspective.
Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further?
That's all. I think that we've covered it, but I certainly will work however you want me to advance this proposal.
And whatever hours.
Whatever hours, Mr. Chair, I stand ready. I think that we have such an incredible opportunity before us, and I think that when you listen to the people who are on, as I call them, the front line of this issue, and companies that want to stay here, that it's really important that we listen to them and what really is the climate out there in our community in terms of economic development.
Senator Saltzman, just so you know what you're getting into, last year during the final days of the session, I went home at 3 o'clock in the morning to take a little nap, and at 4:30 my phone rang to come back.
Mm. Well, so. I'm getting rested up now, Mr. Chair.
Good. I'd suggest that.
Sure.
This is going to be a challenge with the House, I think. I just want everybody to understand that. There's going to be nothing easy about this. Thank you, Chair Lays over Senate File 292 for inclusion in the committee's bill. Thank you. Senator Saltzman, you have another one.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and this really fits together nicely with this package, and this is Senate File 724. I have Mr. Bianco here from Hallin Health Consulting, Richard Carlson from ProUrol Care, and if Mr. Jasolki would also come up from Life Science Alley in case there are technical questions about this bill. So Senate File 724, as we spoke earlier about the insurance pool program, this is a little different program, and that is it is an angel investor tax credit. And, again, this is a different sector, a different stream of dollars. And I'm going to have Mr. Bianco talk about this, but some of the same issues we just talked about in terms of how we're going to help these emerging companies, there are different pots of dollars. And as a product, an idea, a concept advances across the whole commercialization and tech transfer process, there are different streams of dollars that can be accessed. And again, we're hearing from companies in Minnesota that these programs are available in Wisconsin, and Mr. Bianco has been involved with those and can give us some good background on this program. Now, the way that this program works is a little different, and so I'll have him illustrate those ideas.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Peter Bianco. I'm Director of Life Science Business Development for Hallin Health Consulting in Minneapolis. And in my specific role, I work with emerging life science companies, specifically with faculty and early-stage entrepreneurs as they're moving a nascent and promising technology from the research bench into a commercialization path, and help them find the resources necessary to be successful, including financing, resources, human or otherwise, and physical infrastructure in addition to that. My practice currently ranges from Ohio to Phoenix, Arizona, with a heavy emphasis on Madison, Wisconsin, and I work very closely with the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation and the biomedical engineering department there in translating medical device technologies from the research bench into the field. Over the last 5 years, I've been involved with several companies there that have directly benefited from a program called Act 255, which is an angel tax credit that was initiated in 2004. That particular program had a major impact on the success rate by which early-stage technologies could be translated from the bench to the marketplace. Specifically, it was $4 million of tax credits that stimulated $19 million of private equity risk investment into 30 early-stage companies in less than a year. Those companies have gone on. Some have gone out of business, but at least five or six of the promising ones have gone on to hire people to return investment dollars back to their original investors. And those original investors now are taking more money and plowing it back into this system under an expanded tax credit, which has proven to be very successful in the state of Wisconsin. We're also seeing now companies from Minnesota contemplating movement out of the state into Wisconsin to access this program now that it's been expanded. And secondary to that, in the Moorhead, Fargo area, specifically a new incubator that Fargo has put in place, the majority of the companies that are in that incubator in Fargo are Minnesota companies, originated from Minnesota. So the challenge before us today is to understand the psychology of how that tax credit has succeeded in Wisconsin. And not just Wisconsin, but now Ohio and Illinois and other states are contemplating similar measures. But Wisconsin has had a very successful track record with this, and it's now starting to affect us here in Minnesota, because a lot of entrepreneurs that I work with on a daily basis are near the point of giving up and moving. And there is a lot of interest and desire to access the capital wherever they can find it. And at this point, moving to Madison is not a bad option for a lot of them. I would urge you to consider this bill and its specific impact in the timing of what we're going through right now in this particular community.
Thank you.
So we also have Mr. Alexanders here from Twin City Angels and Richard Carlson from Pro Eurocare to give us sort of some frontline experience as well with this program. Go ahead, yes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to present here today. I am CEO of Pro Eurocare. I'm a native Minnesotan. I've been in the medical device field for 32 years, my entire career.
Can we get your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Richard Carlson.
Thank you.
I've been in the medical device field for 32 years, primarily focused on bringing new technology to market as a marketing person. I've spent about half of my career in Minnesota, half of it outside of Minnesota, so I have some perspectives from different areas. But Pro Eurocare, I think, is a true Minnesota example of a small, very small, we have two people, company that successfully raised money over the last 18 months. Our product, just to give you a little sense of what we were attempting to raise money for, is we have an imaging system that identifies abnormal tissue and soft tissue organs. So as an example, our primary focus right now is the prostate, and our system, if it were to image an abnormality in the prostate, it would be highly suspicious. We don't detect cancer, but we do detect abnormalities that should not be present in normal situations. That will lead the physician and the patient on to further diagnostic testing, principally biopsy. Our system can be used in all soft tissue organs, prostate, liver, kidney, lungs. And as we went about trying to raise money, it was very clear, I think, to all investors, there was an extremely large market. It's been talked about in the Wall Street Journal. It's also a market that has a major unmet need, and that involves the two primary diagnostic or screening tools right now do not do a very good job of identifying who may have an abnormal condition. In fact, half of the patients that go to biopsy come back with absolutely nothing. We also know that our product can meet that need. We've done over 250 patients, and we have a clear understanding that we can create images that will assist physicians and patients in their diagnostic decision-making. So with all those things in mind, we went about trying to raise money in January of 2008, and I can't exactly characterize where the market was, but it wasn't as bad as it is now. From January of 2008 until the July of 2008, we raised $2 million, and this was primarily private. It was all private money raised primarily within the state of Minnesota. And when I say private money, I'm talking about individuals. And we'll talk a little bit about the fundraising environment that we faced. That was followed by another small $400,000 private round, and then a secondary public offering, which we started in November of 2008 and completed in January of 2009. All I can tell you is the last $3 million was exceedingly difficult. But again, all of that money came from primarily Minnesota investors, which for us was very gratifying. These are people that, in our nomenclature, were all very networked. None of that money came from organizations. These are all individuals. And what was particularly interesting for me is about a third of those people were people who had really never made a major investment outside of the stock market. So this was sort of their first foray out outside of the real world and in commodity, or excuse me, stock trading, and they placed a bet on a Minnesota company that they felt comfortable with. And there are other Minnesota companies just like us that can do the same thing. One of the issues these people have, however, is A, they have to be aware of who we are. They have to find us. And the people at Life Science Alley are working on that. But the more important part is when we look at these kind of individuals, when I sat down with them, they wrote personal checks, and that had a special meaning to me because it takes on a different kind of flavor than if you're sort of behind a screen or behind an agent of some sort. But the key part for all of these people is we had to provide them an incentive. And the incentive that we provided them was we sold a unit, and a unit was basically composed of a share of stock and a warrant. The share of stock you would have acquired, and all of our money, by the way, was equity. But if in a normal situation they had bought equity, they would have received a share of stock. In our world, they also received a warrant, and the incentive for them was that that warrant had a specified price, which might be worth much more than that in 5 years. That was extremely helpful to me in creating that incentive to purchase. This bill would have made my life immensely easier because that credit would have been immediate. They would have been able to understand the impact of the economics of that decision-making. And when you keep in mind that we had 100 people that generated $6 million, coincidentally, that is an average $60,000 investment. So the bill is really targeted at exactly the kind of person that we were successful in raising money for. Now, as we went about raising money, we didn't just do individuals. We talked to angel groups. They were helpful, but what we generally found is they had 2 to 3 months of due diligence they had to complete. We might have generated some interest among a member or two, but in our world, we would have much rather taken a chance with 6 or 8 individual investors that we can talk one-to-one to. And I think that's the essence of where money can be raised in this state for Minnesota-based companies. And if you use that $50,000 number, that was our target every time we sat down with an investor. And all I can say to you, I guess, is that we were way too early for a venture group. So when you look at how we would anticipate succeeding, we had only one choice, and that was to go to individual investors. To give you a sense of what it might mean if we are successful, we have 2 employees, as I said. We anticipate being through FDA by September or October of this year, which I think you all recognize as a watershed event for a device company. That watershed event, we believe, will help us bring in more cash. We would have never gotten to that point without the $6 million that we received in the last 16 months. The second point I would make is that if we are successful in our 5-year business plan, we anticipate having 70-plus employees in our corporation. And 12 of those people right now are already out in New Jersey as a scientific organization that we partner with. Those 12 people could also come back to Minnesota if we have a successful company here in this state. These people, by nature, are semi-professional or professionals, primarily engineers, scientists, the kind of people that, you know, would generate average incomes in the $60,000 to $75,000 range. So we're only a very small example in our world, but what we've accomplished in the last 16 to 18 months in the markets that we face, if anyone had asked, could we have done it, we weren't guessing we were going to be successful, but we were. This bill would have made it even more likely that we would have been able to succeed. And I think you all know, and I'll close with this comment, it's always interesting to me, the first $5 are the hardest. Once you get the first 50, then people are asking if they can invest. And so you have to get the ball rolling somehow. And as we get the ball rolling in this example, the venture people may have an interest once we get past FDA approval. They may get interested once we get to cash flow positive, but it's that very early period that we have to address here, I think, in terms of being able to raise small amounts of money. And $6 million is actually a large amount, but the point being is that we did that in the state of Minnesota with Minnesota investors. And so I guess I ask that the bill be considered as an enormous stimulus for us. The only issue that I would make is that if it is regionalized, that would pose some significant problems. Our investors came from, I'll give you an example. One of our major investors brought in five guys who put in over $500,000. They happened to be in St. Paul. Those five guys brought in another four guys that put in another $500,000, and they were in the Brainerd Lakes area. So the point is that capital doesn't form around at this level around organizations, and it doesn't form around geography for sure. So if the bill had had the provision that relates to regionalized investments and regionalized fundraising, we would not have been successful in our effort to raise this money. I thank you for your time.
Senator Saltzman, does the governor have any version of this in his budget?
I believe he does, Mr. Chair. This is a broader program. It's not limited. It's not just for green jobs. I believe he also, there was some discussion about some regionalization. And in talking with the angel networks out there, and I think there may be some letters in your packet that are from groups outside the Twin City in rural Minnesota and greater Minnesota, are saying we don't want the regionalization either. Because there has been great success in some of our regional centers around the state with these programs. Obviously, we can do much better. But in listening to the people, again, who are on the front line, they're suggesting it not be limited. And I know Mr. Bianco just mentioned to me, too, that in our earlier discussion of the Minnesota Business Investment Act about exempting certain businesses, he would like to also just speak to that briefly. But I know Mr. Alexander is here as well. So I may be able to speak to some of those questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Alexander. I am founder and chairman of Twin City Angels, a member-owned and managed angel network. We have 39 members, Minnesotans, that have worked together in order to make investments in early-stage companies, more medical and information technology companies than others, but we have retail, green technology, as well as some more esoteric sectors. To put some of my comments in context, give you a little background on myself. St. Jude Medical brought me to Minnesota here in 1992 as the officer of the company in charge of diversifying the business beyond heart valves and into other businesses. If you might recall, St. Jude Medical had the worldwide share of heart valves but was floundering because it could not figure out how to become a bigger company beyond that one particular sector. In the course of 4 years, we grew from $200 million in sales to $840 million in sales, less than 400 people to 2,600 people, and diversified primarily into cardiac rhythm management, the business known for pacemakers, defibrillators, and electrophysiology. I left St. Jude Medical in 1996 and formed Business Development Advisors, a group of individuals focused on developing early-stage technology, again, mostly medical, but we did dabble in information technology and other manufacturing-related industries. We worked in 47 companies over the next 10 years, more in Minnesota than any other geography, but we did work on the East Coast and the West Coast as well. And I held acting officer roles in those in many of those businesses. 3 years ago, I joined a client, a company that became Chameleon Scientific, a medical technology company based in Colorado. I moved that business and the two people that were in that business here to Minnesota, raised private equity, and grew that business to 27 people to a revenue stage. 3 years ago, I launched Twin City Angels, a business model I've been working on for about 4 years after finding no other real vehicle to bring early-stage investors together with entrepreneurs and find a way to bring the experience and the intellect of those successful people together with people who had new ideas but not enough capital and not enough advisors to move them along quickly and efficiently to the point where they could generate revenue. So with that in context, I think there are a number of things the government can do to help early-stage companies be effective and grow quickly. One is keep large companies here. They are the best breeding ground for people with talent, for new products and new spin-off businesses. But keep those successful people here, the people that have driven those businesses, who generate capital. Too many of those leave the state or choose to invest elsewhere. And that's where this particular bill can be extremely effective. And of all the drafts of the bills I've seen since 1999, this is its current draft is by far the best. It is clear that early stage investing is terribly risky. And so creating incentives to create individuals, give them the opportunity and provide them incentive to take money out of their pocket and not invest it in the public markets, regardless of the experience we're having right now. Over time, it is safe, it is liquid. There is an opportunity to understand what's going on in a business differently than typically an early stage company. So individual investors need as much encouragement as possible to make those small investments, the $10,000, the $50,000, the $100,000 investments, to give early stage companies the hundreds of thousands of dollars and the low digit millions of dollars to grow to the point where they are of interest to venture capital firms. So in this particular bill, I would urge you to focus on what you have so far. $6 million is a wonderful start for a amount of money to be available per year. A 25% tax credit is nice leverage. You get four times as much money in for that investment. The ability to take that credit in the year in which you make that investment, again, makes it very attractive and will cause people on the margin to make that decision. And as a result, you'll have a lot of incremental individual bets made by smart people who like a company, who like a technology, who like an industry, and they're going to be willing to make that bet on the margin. I would urge you not to be too terribly prescriptive as to how those investments are made. It is perfectly fine to exclude industries that you think are not appropriate. One of the things that I've been discouraged with in other bills is trying to allocate a percentage of the bill to a particular industry, or to a particular region, or to a particular size. I think if you keep it broad, you will learn very quickly over a year or two or three what works, and then it would be appropriate to tweak it to modify the results. But when you look at other states, Ohio is a wonderful example that has a series of tax credits and encouragements and has others in process to encourage not only companies to relocate, but for individuals to take money out of their pocket. Wisconsin has been heavily discussed so far about their success rate. They have tweaked their program over the last 10 years, both increasing the amount of money and decreasing the restrictions that allow those monies to be invested. And I think this bill is an excellent start at providing that kind of incentive to early-stage companies and to the investors that make them possible. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Alexander, to your comment about allowing individuals to participate as investors, what does line 1.17 mean where it says an accredited investor within the meaning of Regulation B of the Securities and Exchange Commission Code of Regulations Title 17? What does an individual who wants to make investments have to do in order to meet that qualification?
Sure. The SEC has standards that determine what an accredited investor is. An accredited investor either individually or with their spouse, has a certain minimum level of income or a certain level of net worth. It would be responsible for somebody with means that would allow them to not only live their life and pay their mortgage and support their family, to have incremental capital available for investing and for their future. Generally, it's assumed if you're a portfolio manager or financial advisor that you take a small percentage of that capital that you use for savings and invest it in high-risk activities. And so the SEC has set standards of income. I believe it's $250,000 or $300,000 for an individual or family, and net worth of $1 million or more as a minimum before you would be qualified as an accredited investor to invest in a high-risk situation. Does that answer your question? Or?
That's fine.
Yeah, and all investors, Mr. Chairman, when they make that investment and do the paperwork, actually sign a document that acknowledges that they are, in their own words, accredited under those rules and regulations. So it's well regulated.
Right. And for instance, we at Twin City Angels, we do not accept any member who is not an accredited investor. So not only do we work collectively to pool funds to put them into companies, but each of our individuals, members individually are accredited investors.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander.
Thank you.
Commissioner Reines? Commissioner Reines, can maybe you could come up. I have a question for the commissioner. Commissioner, I don't remember when we went through the governor's tax bill. I don't remember how much money he had in a program very similar to this. Can you off the top of your head remember?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue. And my recollection was it was about $6 million, I believe. And as the senator said, our bill is
$6 million
per year, same amount. Thank you. And as the senator said, our bill is somewhat different. I would say more prescriptive than the senator's bill.
But the same number, the same amount of money that
correct.
Senator Saltzman is.
Correct.
And, Commissioner, how did the, if this bill then was kind of piggybacked off of the governor's budget numbers, how did the governor arrive at $6 million as being the right number? Do we know that? And that might be a better question for the Commissioner of Deed. But
yeah, you know, they were the primary architects of the credit. The amount of we put into the credit, we capped it at $6 million. Was really a function. We've introduced a bill numerous years, as you know. This has been one of the governor's perennial tax initiatives. I think every year he's introduced some kind of variation of the venture capital tax credit. And it really was, we've traditionally done about $6 million range. And I think his idea was do what's affordable at this time, get something in law, see how it works. Oftentimes credits like this have to be revised over time when you figure out how the market's going to react to the credit. We did our best to try to mirror it after some other credits are already in law in other states. Wisconsin has one that has a good track record. So we tried to take some of the virtues of that credit. But the $6 million, you know, there was no science behind that. We had a spreadsheet like you're probably working off right now. And, you know, it's a zero-sum game. So $6 million was kind of enough, we thought, to make it meaningful enough for investors like the people at the table to take advantage of it. At least get it out on the books and see how it works.
Commissioner, you probably heard I went on a little tirade here yesterday morning about we. It just seems like as a state, we're not putting enough emphasis on job creation. And Commissioner, I just got to tell you, if the governor's priority is to try to grow jobs, we shouldn't be restrained by a spreadsheet. If a program works and will create employment, that should be a priority on the spreadsheet. You know, but the governor made, I guess, maybe a higher priority of cutting corporate income taxes than creating jobs under this program, and I'm troubled by that. And I expressed that yesterday because I do hope that a large component of this tax bill, everybody's going to talk about the tax increase, but I said this yesterday, is going to be creating some opportunities for investment in job growth in Minnesota. And we're going to spend a lot of time, I hope, talking about that in the conference committee. And I just was wondering where the $6 million came from and if it was just, if it's the right number and we don't think we can push more money than that out the door to do job creation, well, then $6 million's fine. But I think if we could move 8 out and create additional jobs, We've all heard the state economist saying here that we're going to lose another 100,000 jobs before the end of the year, and we need to make some effort to try to turn that around. And maybe in this environment, this economy, maybe we can't even get $6 million spent. Maybe there just aren't enough opportunities out there to invest in this economy. I don't know, but.
Chairman, may I?
Commissioner?
You know, I did hear a portion of your tirade yesterday, Chairman.
I figured somebody was listening.
And I think I'd like to set the record straight on one point, Chairman, and that's that the metrics the governor used when putting together his tax proposal was almost exclusively what can we do to generate additional job creation in Minnesota. And so when you talk about the reducing the corporate franchise tax by 50%, that really was a realization that tax is a impediment to job creation. We need to reduce it. We did what we could within the confines of the budget we had. But every decision we made in the context of the tax realm, at least, the primary, if not exclusive, metrics was how will that impact job creation? Upfront exemption on capital equipment, how will it affect job creation? Reducing the corporate franchise tax, how will that create impact job creation? And these boutique items are very important. I don't question these boutique tax credits that are targeted and surgical are very important. But the governor thought it was a higher priority to deal with some of our broad systemic issues. And I think the corporate franchise tax and the upfront exemption on capital equipment are long-term systemic issues that have been a hindrance to job creation. And he thought we should first try to address those. And then with any revenue we had left over, try to do some of these boutique issues. You know, the Small Business Investment Act, the Angel Investment Tax Credit, some of those things that are more surgical. But first and foremost, address some of the systemic issues that have plagued our system for a long time.
Commissioner, it's just a place the governor and I don't agree. I mean, I just don't believe that cutting the corporate income tax for a retail business or for a bank is going to do anything to stimulate the economy. I mean, people are either going to buy something at a retail business or they're going to go to the bank and conduct some business with a bank if it makes sense. And those things are going to happen regardless of what the corporate tax rate is. I don't agree that on its face, cutting the corporate income tax does anything in huge sectors of our economy that may benefit from that it does anything to create jobs. We're going to talk more about that, I guess, in the conference committee, but I just haven't bought into that strategy. Senator Saltzman?
Well, just another point, Mr. Chair. You might want to know that Wisconsin, who we're competing with, also has a $5.7 billion deficit, and they've expanded this program from $5.5 million to $18 million for job creation. That, you know, a state that has seen the impact of this and sees the great potential is investing in this program. And when they create that program, they're competing with us again. So, you know, being able to, again, have this program here so we can keep our jobs here is very, very important.
Mr. Chairman, regarding your comment on opportunities, Twin City Angels has reviewed 197 Minnesota companies over the last 3 years. Of those, we had the capital to invest in 12. You know, this type of legislation, and if your interest is to expand it in terms of dollars, would make more money available to more companies.
And so there are opportunities.
There is a target-rich environment out here, and what happens is the good ideas get funded someplace. And if they don't get funded here, they get funded more often on the West Coast. Way too many companies have moved to Ohio. A few have moved to Georgia. Boston and the Cambridge area is a very attractive area for medical technology companies. And, you know, Minnesota has a very strong information technology sector, internet, software, and hardware, and those are easily relocatable to centers where there are those types of resources. So anything we can do to keep them here, anything we can do to make capital available, will create more opportunities for companies and jobs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moi.
If Senator Scheid has something on this point, I'd be glad to defer to her.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just that I think I have understood that Ohio is using tobacco settlement money. It poured a lot of money into these credits, and I was wondering, gee, why couldn't we do that?
Senator Scheid, I believe we receive about $200 million a year in money from the tobacco settlements permanently, and it goes into the general fund.
Yes.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, this is a, it's not directly on point, but I wondered if some of our witnesses could share their perspective a little bit. I was very concerned when I was approached by the University of Minnesota about their attempt to try to do some investments with venture capitalists. And they said that because they're a public institution whose information is readily available through the Freedom of Information Act, and that they're not unique in this, but that many, many research universities, particularly in California and Michigan and others, are experiencing a phenomenon where they're being disinvited or uninvited from participating in some of these venture capital opportunities because they are, in essence, through the competitive process, they're being forced to give up perhaps information that other individuals who participate in these venture capitals would be able to keep confidential as part of the process. And it greatly concerns me because I would hate for us to do all of this and then have the University of Minnesota or some of our other institutions that would have the opportunity to participate not be able to participate because of the potential to have to, you know, give up trade secrets or compromise potential information. Can you reflect a little bit on that, given your experience in the industry?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's a little different animal with respect to later stage investments and larger venture funds, and you're talking about CalPERS specifically, and they're backing away from or being disinvited, as you said, to participate in as limited partners in large venture funds, largely because of disclosure rules that these venture funds place on publicly public entities, such as pension funds like that. It's somewhat of a recent phenomenon, but I believe we're seeing at the very beginning, and I think this might shed some light on that, but I'm still not sure because this is a new phenomenon. In that the venture capital market is restructuring. Risk capital is restructuring due to the economic downturn. There's no getting around that. There's a fairly significant shakeout going on. Some of these funds that are, I would say, mid to lower tier funds that have participated in the venture firms as venture firms with limited partners taking public money have not performed that well. And so there is a restructuring and a shrinking of more successful firms, I think, fewer firms looking at fewer deals and across the country, and a lot of specific funds and specifically to pension funds not being invited because those venture firms then are in a position of disclosing their returns to their limited partners in a public way, which they don't want to do. Okay, that's one aspect of it. Wisconsin, on the other hand, by virtue of how they have structured their University of Wisconsin specifically, and this wasn't specific to do that, but Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation is a private entity that does invest as a limited partner in certain types of funds, and they can do that, which kind of shields the University of Wisconsin specifically from disclosing either a public disclosure on the part of technologies from the University of Wisconsin into the public realm, or a venture fund having to disclose its either performance or underperformance. And largely it's an avoidance of wanting to disclose underperformance. But again, this is far different from this. This is very early stage. In the angel world and translating an idea direct from, you know, where ideal and where most of this type of legislation would be helpful is translating early stage technologies from the research bench into the marketplace. Venture capital firms very rarely participate that early. So this is a little more of a downstream issue.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? Senator Pogue?
Chair, after between bills, I just wanted to comment on the commissioner's comments.
Okay. I have a technical question. Senator Salzman, on page 2, line 26, kind of following along with what Senator Pogemiller brought up on the previous bill, is that 51% number the right number?
That, Mr. Chair, is probably open to this committee to decide. This is a starting point. And again, I think that this bill was modeled after what other states have done. And certainly I think that listening to the people, we want to grow jobs, you know, here in Minnesota. And I think that's something that could be discussed. If there's any other comments, Mr. Alexander, do you see any issues with the 51%?
I don't. I think it is fairly customary if you look at other states. I think benchmarking against other states is critical as people look for incrementally where do they make that investment. And if we're at parity with other states, that certainly should be fine.
Okay. Thank you. We'll check on that. Anything else, Senator Salzman?
Well, I'd just like to, again, comment that I want to thank everyone who has worked on this bill, that it did not come out of nowhere, that it really came from working with many different groups. Life Science Alley, the High Tech Association, the Bell Business Alliance has been incredibly helpful in doing this. And I think that this isn't just about having this tool. It's what goes along with it in terms of us marketing this and making sure that businesses in Minnesota, what we've heard is that this is really, that this particular initiative and also the other bill that you heard is really putting a sign out in Minnesota that we're open for business for these emerging companies, that we value them, that we believe that there is a role for government to support their development. And I think this is where we really bring together public, you know, like our public sector, our private sector, and also our academic sector. And that's what we've talked about in our business committee, is that we've got to bring all those groups together to make sure that we're positioned for success in Minnesota. And this is one tool to make that happen, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Salzman. Anybody else that would like to speak on Senate File 724? Seeing none, the chair will lay Senate File 724 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, committee. It's a pleasure to be before you today.
Senator Pogue-Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to comment on the commissioner's comments. Commissioner, as you know, I have great respect for your thinking on tax policy. And I just wanted to challenge this notion that the approach in the governor's bill is to go after the systemic problem. And I presume that means taxes are too high on business, because that's kind of the general thrust of the governor's approach. And I just think we need to be evidence-based here. And prior to this approach, Minnesota led the nation in income growth and job growth during the 90s. Frankly, for the last 20 or 30 years. But now that we've come to this new view that if you do job Z and lower taxes totally for business, it's all going to work out, I think the evidence is that's a failed strategy. Now, it's hard to totally separate the national, international economic situation from Minnesota's. So I grant that we're caught up in something much bigger here. But prior to this collapse, it was real evident that whatever we were doing in job strategy in Minnesota wasn't working, because we had fallen from a leader nationally to the middle of the pack. So I just challenge this notion that somehow this systemic problem that the governor is going after is this bad business climate. The business climate apparently wasn't too bad for 25 or 30 years when we led the nation in job growth. But now that the governor keeps talking about it and making just outrageous claims that we're 40th or 45th in business climate, just outrageous claims, and saying that the systemic problem is corporate income taxes, I just think that's not well thought out. I don't think it's accurate, and I don't think it serves our state right now, because we know Job Z is a failed strategy. Pretty much everything we've done during this last 4 or 5 years appears to be a failed strategy. And I just don't think we should sit here and act as if more of that is going to help us. And I think we ought to move on from that. Perhaps some of these strategic type things that are being talked about today might help, but I would just caution us. I wouldn't use Wisconsin as a good example. There's a lot of evidence that Minnesota is going to overtake Wisconsin in the next census. And we know there's been a brain drain from Wisconsin to Minnesota. And so some notion that Wisconsin's on the right track here, the evidence seems to be otherwise. And so I think we need to be real careful. We need to be strategic. We did support, and there has been support, for single sales and things like that. But, you know, there's some evidence that that might not have worked either. So, Commissioner, I just, in a thoughtful way, I just wanted to challenge this basic premise that the governor's systemic approach makes sense. Because I think if his systemic approach is to just hold the line on taxes, there's just an overwhelming amount of evidence that that cuts our ability to make strategic investments, which appeared to be a smart strategy for about 20 or 30 years in Minnesota, where we led the nation in job growth. We invested in higher ed. We invested in education. We invested in the workforce. When we had 10% unemployment in the early 80s, we literally did a wage subsidy. We invested in employees, and that led to a coming out of that recession much quicker. And I really question this notion that somehow lowering taxes in general gets you there. I just think that's a failed strategy. Job Z is clearly a failed strategy, clearly. And that was the basic premise of Job Z.
Commissioner, do you want to get into it, or should we move on to Senator Ortman?
Well, maybe just one quick comment. Chairman, Senator Pogomiller, you know, I know we're going to have a very robust debate about what is the right strategy as far as investment versus taxes versus, you know, just overall fiscal policy. You know, I think the governor has said on many occasions that we're never going to be a low-cost, low-tax state. We'll stipulate to that. But we need to be in the range of competitiveness that makes us a viable contender for jobs. And you're right, Senator. We've lost a lot of jobs over the last, you know, number of years. And at some point, this economy is going to turn around. At some point, those jobs are going to come back. But it is not preordained they're going to come back in Minnesota. I mean, those jobs that Hutchinson Tech has laid off, 3M, Best Buy, Target, some of our premier employers, it is not preordained those jobs are coming back here. They will make another calculus in 6 months, 12 months, when they're making hire decisions. Does it make sense to put those jobs back in Minnesota? And an advantage we had was being the place where these businesses grew. And, you know, there was some organic ownership to those jobs, and that's gone. And they need to make a decision based on the business metrics and the business.
Right.
And that's why cost matters. I think that when we talk about 20, 30 years ago, the world has changed. Capital is more fluid and more mobile. Employers have more options at their disposal. This is not the 3M of 30 years ago. They have options all over the world, and they're exercising those options. And just one more point, Senator. You know, the governor is not his proposal is not a massive tax reduction on businesses. It is, by and large, a surgical reduction on those taxes we think are the greatest impediment to capital formation and ultimately job creation. We did not come forward with our corporate tax reduction in a vacuum. We looked extensively at the evidence, academic evidence, economic analysis from all sides of the political spectrum, and decided that there was probably the one tax, if we went after one, that's the one where we can move the meter the most. We didn't propose a massive income tax reduction. We just didn't have, this wasn't the right time to do it. So it's not as if the governor's asking us to be a low-tax, low-cost state. He says we need to be competitive.
Senator Pogomiller. Chairman, just very briefly, the world has changed, but economics hasn't changed. Cost mattered over the last 30 years, too. And those companies you're talking about grew here. They grew here under supposedly this terrible climate. The world has changed. Those companies have changed. And cheap labor matters. We cannot compete for cheap labor. We can't. Our society won't accept that. So you have to make strategic decisions, as the people before us did, as to what were the changes you make that allow the kinds of companies that want to grow and can grow here to grow here. You don't keep chasing something that just can't happen because of the basic economics. We're never going to be New York City, the financial center of the world, and thank God we weren't Wall Street right now. But there's nothing we can do to become Wall Street. And some of the jobs that are moving out of our state, we can't stop that. And to use those jobs moving as the argument to go down a failed strategy, I don't think makes sense. That's misconnecting the dots. And that's what I fear the governor does. I think he misconnects the dots and then says we have the 40th worst or 45th worst business climate in the country. I just don't think the evidence supports that.
Commissioner, we only have till 11 o'clock, so we're going to have more opportunity to have this discussion. So,
I appreciate it, Chairman.
Appreciate it,
Senator.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langston.
You know, I think it's been clear when businesses have been polled about their number one problem that the lack of a qualified workforce in the future is their number one problem. So taxes are part of it, but they're a ways down. But the adequate qualified workforce is their biggest fear.
Well, Senator Langseth, all the data I've looked at, all the studies I've looked at bear that out. Everyone that I've looked at, we got a whole box of them, says that when a business wants to make a location to relocate or expand, that the first thing they look at is the availability of a workforce.
That matches what they're trying to do.
Every study shows that is their number one criteria. You can't grow a business that doesn't have an adequate pool of qualified employees. Senator Ortman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill proposes a new tax. It's the first time I've ever proposed a new tax. And so,
how's it feel?
I definitely feel like I'm on the hot seat. But that's all right. I've been a lightning rod before. I probably will be again. So I'm back in a zone of comfort here. Mr. Chair and members, this bill proposes a tax on interest rates that are charged to Minnesotans every single day. We know that Minnesotans pay interest rates on credit cards. They pay interest on their mortgages, pay interest at the dry cleaners. They pay interest on payday loans. It's enormous, the industry of lending in the state of Minnesota, and it's enormous how much Minnesotans pay in interest. And in some instances, we know that interest lenders can be acting in predatory ways. We know that they are acting in usurious ways. We cannot regulate commerce in the state of Minnesota. I understand that. I think everybody knows that the federal government preempts us from doing that. And so this bill does not regulate commerce. It does, however, raise a tax, which is within our constitutional authority as a state, and it will help us to balance our budget, which I think is an important goal and probably the main reason that I've offered this tax as a solution this year. My question to the members and to the public, to the governor, is how should we balance the budget and who should pay? And members, I believe that lenders should step up and help us pay. Members, 15% interest should be more than enough interest in an economy when banks can borrow at the federal funds rate of 0.25%. Actually, as of yesterday, it was 0.13% as of 4:15 yesterday afternoon. The prime lending rate hovers at 3%. 3% is the best rate available to the best customers of our lenders. Charging 15% interest on funds obtained at 0.25% yields a stratospheric 6,000% rate of return. That's just at 15%. Members, 15% tax or interest is not affected in this bill. You can charge up to 15%. There's no tax. You can yield a 6,000% rate of return, and there's no impact in this bill. If lenders charge more than 15%, then the profit margins should be taxed to help pay the societal costs of predatory and usurious lending. Foreclosures, credit card judgments are overwhelming burdens in our courts and county offices. We have bank and insurance company bailouts that are going to be charged back to our children and our grandchildren. And the state bears a burden in providing the safety net for folks who agreed to loans that lenders recklessly failed to qualify or loans that were intentionally priced for a high rate of default. As a state, you know, we face record levels of unemployed Minnesotans with lost health insurance benefits and pensions, enormous costs to our justice system, and businesses that cannot obtain the credit they need to continue operations, reinvest for new hires, training, and purchasing new equipment. The loss of confidence in our lending institutions has had a crippling effect on our economy, and lenders should be part of the solution. The special interest lobbyists here will contend that this tax will be shifted to the cost of borrowing and further tighten the credit market. Please don't be fooled by that argument. If there is any tightening, the effect will be to discourage precisely the sort of reckless lending that got us here in the first place. Sound and healthy lending practices will remain unaffected by the proposed tax. If lending institutions continue to engage in risky and reckless lending, then they should face the loss without the guarantee of the taxpayers, and they should pay taxes up front for the costs they shift to Minnesotans for the legal remedies we provide in our courts and county offices. Let me be very clear. I prefer not to raise any tax. But if we have to raise taxes to resolve our deficit and stimulate economic recovery, then this is the right tax at the right time for the right reasons. And it places the burden squarely where it should fall. These lending institutions, and not just the executives, have profited immensely by their greed. For perspective, this bill will raise $215 million to $300 million in the next biennium. The one guy at AIG that created the credit default swaps and sold them with the promise that they would never go bad, he was paid $500 million in his course of 8 years of employment at AIG, and that guy is still being paid as a consultant. The lending institutions made huge profits when borrowers made their payments for the first 10 to 36 months before they defaulted. They benefited again by repackaging and selling the remaining debts as securities, borrowing against the proceeds of bad loans, or reducing their tax liability for write-offs, losses as bad debt, they didn't pay tax. To add insult to the taxpayers' injury, they were offered big government bailouts to buy off their toxic assets and clean up their balance sheets. So I ask you today to join me in the conversation here at the Capitol. Who should pay for the state's budget deficit, and shouldn't they be asked to step up and participate in the solution? Members, I am very pleased to have with me today Mr. Mark Thompson, who is the Hennepin County Court Administrator, and he is here in support of this bill.
Mr. Thompson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to tell you what I know about.
We need to have you state your name.
Mark Thompson, Hennepin County Court Administrator. I need to tell you up front what I know about tax policy, and that is I knew if I didn't pay $288 to the IRS yesterday, they were going to charge me 5% by July 1st, so I took care of that, and that's my some knowledge of tax policy. As the court administrator of Hennepin County, you may have I've experienced and you may have seen several articles that have been written by local newspapers regarding the default portion of our court activity. That is when people who are debtors cannot pay the creditor and do not comply with the creditor's allegation about nonpayment. We have many of these in Hennepin County, and I just want to talk about that specific part of our operation, not offer any advice on tax policy. I want to be real clear about that. In Hennepin County last year, we had 12,878 default judgments. Default judgments are, again, those broken down relationships between creditor and debtor. A majority of those are credit card payments. The next highest amount are auto loans and leases. The third highest amount, and this surprised me, I would have thought it was cell phones, but it's gym memberships. All of those things wound up being at 12,878 filings in Hennepin County, 37% increase in 2008 over 2007. In our rolling year, which is the number of months we had this year so far compared to the number of months last year, we're looking at almost a 50% increase in these default judgments. There are many reasons for that, and I'm sure you'll debate that at length. But the issue for us as the Hennepin County District Court becomes we have now 3.5 FTEs doing that job where we had 1.75 doing it a year ago because there are so many endemic problems with the cases that are coming through. There are bankruptcies in the federal court attached to these. There are other credit issues. There are loss of jobs, et cetera. So 3.5 FTEs in Hennepin County District Court just to do this one simple function. I want to give you perspective. There are 760,000 filings in Hennepin County District Court last year. 12,878 were default judgments. The year before, roughly 8,000 were default judgments. This year, we expect about 15,000 to 16,000 in default judgments. For the entire state, there were 51,306 default judgments filed in 2008 at a cost of, in terms of the court clerk cost, this is a $63,000 per unit court clerk that you would see when you went to your local courthouse, a cost there of about $800,000. So when you do the math on that, it's about 12 FTEs statewide doing nothing but default judgments every day, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week. So that's the issue we have seen. We do not, accompanying that, we have seen increased lines in our violations bureau where people pair their tickets, parking tickets and speeding tickets, which has maybe something to do with this, maybe not. We have seen a rise in housing court filings. I'm sure that has been documented in Senator Moaz's Judiciary Committee. And a variety of other increases related to economic downturn. When you anecdotally ask my staff who deal frontline with these people in housing, default, and the Violations Bureau, kind of where our bread and butter participants in court come in to pay their or to deal with their issues, they will tell you it's because they have lost their jobs or they have no longer the ability to pay their bills.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, the summary talks about an amendment. So I is it says as proposed to be amended, and it would be helpful to me to see that.
Let's
Mr. Chair, it's the A3.
The only reason I wanted to get the testimony before the amendment was the testimony, I'm sure, is geared to the bill because that's what the public has had. But we can
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful to people testifying if they knew what the bill was going to possibly look like. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
Senator Ortman moves the A3 amendment. And members, this is the delete everything, so let's just get it on the bill, and then we'll have Senator Ortman speak to it. On the Ortman motion on the A3 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A3 is adopted. Senator Ortman, to your amended bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The tax is structured as a surtax on interest income, and you'll see the definitions that apply. We're talking about 15% annual percentage rates. And as I've said, it applies to every type of loan where there's interest charged. And the effective date would be December 31, 2008, so it applies to all 2009 transactions. The intention is that if a person is conducting trade pursuant to the regulation Z with interest, that also would be taxed.
So really, the amendment, Senator Ortman, really doesn't change the intent of the bill.
Mr.
It
Chair,
still is a 30%. Now we call it a surtax instead of whatever, an interest rate.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, because I think there were many people that were confusing this tax with a sales tax. This is not a sales tax. It is an income tax, and it needs to be treated that way. We also wanted to make sure that we structured it properly so that the Department of Revenue could prepare forms and things like that. So they've looked at it to determine whether or not they can prepare a form to send out so that folks can understand how to calculate the tax. But it applies to Minnesota residents who pay interest and all lenders who receive it. They pay an income tax, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, is it limited just to credit cards? I'm having trouble. It looks like it applies to mortgages.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, it applies to all loans that are charged over 15%. It would include oftentimes some subprime lenders. It's likely to apply to second and third mortgages that are often charged at 15, 16, 17%. If the loan, again, is charged at interest 15% or less, there's no tax. It's only for those where the interest rate is over 15%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that if you could explain how that, I guess it's probably on the surtax rate on page 3. It says it would be imposed 30% attributable on income attributable to interest earned to that portion that exceeds 15% on the principal balance. At some point, you probably hit that 15% pretty quickly in a mortgage. I mean, on the balance. Once you've paid, I mean, I could be wrong, but are you talking about what the listed interest rate is, the APR, or the effective interest? It matters.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And so can you tell me?
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to our counsel
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, in the definitions, the annual percentage rate is the rate which should be disclosed, which the Regulation Z requires lenders to initially disclose that rate, so it's tied to the APR, which is on every disclosure initially done. And so it would be that that's in the definition section. So it's the APR listed, which all lenders must list for credit card companies, any kind of loan that's offered, consumer loan.
A mortgage. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, so I know when you get a mortgage today, let's say you had an $81,000 mortgage, which I had once, and I was going to pay something over $300,000. You know, if I paid that for 30 years, that's what I would
the APR
would owe. So that's, I mean, at some point, it doesn't look like it's talking about at the moment you take it out. It looks like it's accumulative. At any time it exceeds that principal, more than 15% of the principal balance.
Mr. Chair, it should follow your payment. So if your payment is a payment at 8%, there's no tax. If your payment on the loan is 18%, then you pay 30% on that portion over 3% of that payment. The lender pays.
Senator Ortman, if you have a home mortgage at 15%, and you sign that mortgage with your bank, this tax doesn't apply.
Right.
You have an annual interest rate of 15%, this tax does not apply. But if it's 16%, the tax is 30% of the 1%, the portion that's over 15%.
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's what that says on page 3, but...
Well, we'll take a look at the language, okay. But I think that's Senator Ortman's intent. That's my understanding of it. I think that's counsel's understanding of it. So if we don't quite have the language right, we'll make sure we get it right.
And, Mr. Chairman, I just have to tell you that when I started selling real estate, I was selling homes at 17.5 plus a half. It was a baptism by fire.
Did you sell some homes?
Yes.
I remember when I got out of college, my wife and I were trying to save some money to start building a home. So we rented the first couple years. And I can remember we were both working. We had no kids. We were trying to put some money into six-month money markets. And the interest rate on the six-month money market was 16% interest. Senator Ortman, you're not old enough to remember that.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say that now that rate of return would be about 1% in the market that we're in.
Or less. Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I think perhaps when we consider this, we should maybe figure out a way to accommodate the change in interest rate that occurs. And, you know, we're at historic lows now. But, you know, as Senator Scheid said, some of us are old enough to remember when we were paying that type of interest rate, and perhaps there needs to be some mechanism that would allow the 15% to kind of track up and down a little bit, and I don't know what it is, but we should.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, that is a great question and something I looked at, but I want to make sure that we distinguish what we're doing from regulating commerce. And so if you structure it that way, it looks like it's adjusting in, you know, according to interest rates. And so I think we'd be better off setting the rate statutorily and adjusting it every 2 years or 4 years or looking at it again. But we do have to carefully distinguish our actions here from regulating commerce in order to make this an appropriate tax.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I understand your concern about that, Senator Ortman, but it seems to me we're still just determining where the tax applies in the Senator Scoy's thing is not regulating commerce. It's just determining when the tax kicks in, and the fact that it floats with the market doesn't. I mean, it seems to me we have other taxes that are based on things that. It's just determining. I mean, our income tax rates bump up, the tax brackets bump up with inflation. This would be bumping up with the interest rate. It seems to me it's still just a tax, and I think Senator Scoy's point's worth considering.
Mr. Chair, I do not oppose that at all. I just want to make sure that we are clearly following what are the limitations of what we can do, and I would seek further counsel on that from legal counsel, and if we can work that in the next iteration, I'm very supportive of that.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think we'll have a discussion whether there are any commerce issues relative to making some kind of trigger maybe tied to the federal funds rate or some unit of measurement and not get ourselves in trouble with commerce. But I think Senator Scoy brings up a reasonable point. I don't think it impacts the revenue estimate on the bill because I don't think anybody assumes interest rates are going to explode over the next 4 years. But
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, how does this affect payday loans? You know, I think they're kind of sharks and they're way too high, but let's suppose you borrow for a week to get you to payday. If you paid a 50% interest, you'd only be paying 1% on that loan, which probably wouldn't even be profitable for the person doing the lending because just the paperwork would be, say on $500, they'd make $5. And I was just wondering, would this, this basically I think would put them out of business. Maybe that's good, I don't know. But this applies to them as well?
Mr. Chair, I honestly, and Senator Langseth, I'm not that familiar with the lending practices of the payday lenders. If they did go out of business, I know that there are some people that might suffer some hardship there. I'm puzzled by that. It's a quagmire for me whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. There's been testimony, I think, at the Capitol both ways on that. But it definitely would be included in this tax.
Well, Senator Langseth, to your point, I mean, if I was going to borrow you money for a week or two, I mean, wouldn't a 15% annual rate of return be enough?
No. No, it wouldn't. Because
are you a shark, too?
Well, let's say you borrow $500 from me, and it's at 15%. That would be like one-third of 1%. It'd probably $1.50 or something like that. And how could I ever write up the legal part of it or anything for $1.50?
Yeah.
I mean, I would, as a friend, I probably wouldn't charge you interest, but $1.50 probably wouldn't keep me in business. I mean, I think this extremely short-term thing, and like I say, I think some of them are way too high, but this doesn't work for that kind of a business.
15 times 5 if it's $500.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that, on the payday lending issue, and Senator Langseth, you said, yeah, maybe it, some people would argue it is a good thing to put them out. We had some long discussions about this in Commerce, but the Legislative Commission on Poverty last year, it was one of the recommendations that we either severely restrict or stop the predatory lending practices. And here you're talking 300%, 400% a year APR. I mean, that's what they break down to. But they do have fees. I mean, in other words, I think this is, depending on how they classify things as fees, a lot of what they're doing is fee-based. So I'm not sure exactly how it applies, but I think it would be a pretty good thing to have it apply to them. Whether the 15% is the right number, I'm not sure, but the practice is predatory, and it is a big concern.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shad.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of those cases where numbers don't tell the whole story. I mean, if you I have an example of you need to buy a refrigerator and it's 18% APR. Okay, so you don't pay 18% each month. That's the annualized percentage rate. So you probably pay, I think, like 1.5%. I think that would be right? 12 into 18 would be 1.5. So the first month you pay 1.5% interest, and you pay it on the remaining balance. And the next month that principal comes down, and you pay 1.5% on. So the actual dollar amount is going to go down. I mean, as you pay, you're not going to pay. That would, okay, for 1 month, it would be $7.50 interest on a $500 loan. The next month, it might be $7.49 or $7.48, so it comes down. But so annualized is not what's charged each month. I mean, maybe we all know that, but that's, I think, gets confusing. And then you have the issue, and I understand, I mean, Senator Marty was right, we did have a long conversation. Is there some value in having small loans available to people who need them? And you just have to weigh that. And maybe you say no, because they pay too much for it, so no. They may need to get their car fixed to go to work, but no, we've decided they have to pay too much to do that, so forget that. You know, we don't make that option available to get that small loan if you cut down, if you completely eliminate payday lending. Are there abuses? Yes. But I think we have to weigh all of these things, and that's what I guess we're doing here.
Well, I think Senator Shide, the issue is at some point, at some interest rate, it's considered to be excessive.
Mr. Chairman, one of my favorite stories was
sky's not the limit.
Mr. Chairman, one of my favorite stories was a guy who was in an airport, didn't have cash, charged a pack of gum for a buck and a quarter, I think. And when the bill came, he thought, well, that's goofy. I'm not going to pay that. And had, you know, like a $25 late fee. What was his, you know, interest rate was something over 1,000% or whatever, I mean, on that pack of gum. You know, he probably never did it again. But what are we? We're just apparently regulating the stated APR. So that's the intent of Senator Ortman, that if it says it's 14.99%, then no problem. No matter how long you have the loan, no matter how much you actually pay in interest, and it may go over 15% of the principal balance at any time, I would assume.
Senator Shide, on that pack of gum that cost $25, I've always paid my credit card bill out of two checkbooks. I've always kept my gas that I use separately and pay that out of kind of a expense account checkbook. And I remember one month my credit card bill came, and I did the math and wrote out the two checks, and I sent them in, and I was 1 cent off, 1 penny off, just a mathematical error on my point. When my next bill came, I had a $40 service charge on my credit card bill because I was a penny off. I was charged the 1.5% or whatever it was on the entire balance because I didn't pay my balance on time. That's not fair.
No, I agree, Mr. Chairman.
That's not fair. No, I called them, and they graciously removed it. And I was glad to know that the person I called lived in Fargo, North Dakota, not in Singapore or, you know, somewhere, because I always ask. And the other question you want to ask is when they give you their name and their name is Gene, ask them what their real name is. And some of them will be honest with you about that. Senator Roman?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify that we are talking about the annual percentage rate. It's not the total interest paid. It's the interest rate charged. Right. That
Senator
we're
Marty.
Taxing. And Mr. Ron Elwood is here as well, and he can address the payday lending. He's an expert on that issue, and so I would defer to him on some of those concerns that committee
Senator
has.
Marty, Mr. Elwood, your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First of all, I really want to commend Senator Ortman for the creative thinking. I think it's really innovative. Just in terms of the discussion with respect to what the actual tax would be on a payday loan, under Section 4760, and this is a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and math was my worst subject in school. So just with that, at $100 under the Consumer Small Loan Act, the amount of interest is 15%, which translates into $390%. My calculations would be, so out of the $15, the tax on the overage would be $4.14. So that's what they pay out of the $15 fee interest, just as a sense for reference for the committee. And I just also want to mention, I want to preface my remarks by just saying, you know, we've had a bill, as you probably many of you know, on payday lending this year. And while we didn't achieve our primary goal, we did have a series of negotiations with all the players in the payday industry. And so I really want to recognize their efforts in coming to a compromise with us and really appreciate the work that they've done to get to a place where we have a compromise bill. So I really want to thank the industry. And that said, though, that Senator Ortman's proposal as it relates to this industry would probably hit the bullseye she's aiming at because, you know, regardless of whether or not you believe that payday lending and payday loans are necessary, I think most would agree that the rates are exorbitantly high. And But because those fees are capped and the rates are capped, with this particular industry, they would not be able to pass the tax along to consumers. So for this industry anyway, this bill would serve to either lower the rates or raise revenues or do both. Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's important, yeah, because payday lenders are capped and they're at the caps, and I'd object to the fact where the caps are, but I mean the reality is that's where they are, and so this would be paid by them. The one thing in terms of the small loans like that, I think the state wisely cracked down on some of the tax anticipation loans, because we realize we're putting in, with a lot of low-income people, we're putting in the earned income, the working family tax credit. We're putting public money in there, and then they're skimming it off the top at outrageous, really outrageous interest rates. And the payday lending, again, the same thing. I think that was one of the issues in the fact that this may tax that industry. I think it's they're the ones who ought to be paying it. So I think this is the right track. I mean, I know it's very complicated how to calculate it, so it doesn't, and I don't know if 15% is the right interest rate, but I do think on some of those predatory loans it would be appropriate.
Senator Ortman, do you have anybody else to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I know that there is some opposition, and I would like to respond to the opposition after they've had a chance to testify.
You're a member of the committee, Senator Ortman. You're going to get the last word.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question.
Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, and this may have already been answered when I was out in the hall, but what would prevent a credit card company from just line listing a surcharge on their bill and just passing this directly on to a credit card customer?
Well, Mr. Chair, and Senator Senjum, what would happen is, number one, more credit card holders would cut up their credit cards. Number two, more of them would pay them off, wouldn't miss payments. And so I think there are some reasons that they would not want to pass this tax along. I also think that there will be a diminishing nature to this tax, that once we charge it like our tobacco tax, it will turn out that there will be less and less revenue because they will stop lending at that rate. So I think that there are lots of impacts that will occur, and I think most of them positive.
Let's see. Who do we have? Who would like to go first? We have Alicia Schlander, Joe Witt, and Tom Hesse. We probably need you all to come up at the same time. We're getting kind of pinched for time here.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber does oppose Senate File 506 for several reasons. First, we still believe, despite the changes that have occurred in the amendment, that this looks to us like an unapportioned gross receipts tax rather than a surtax on the income tax. And if it is likely unconstitutional. Courts around the country, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have ruled that unapportioned gross receipts taxes are unconstitutional. And the reason we feel that is there's no deduction for bad debt or any of the costs associated with earning the interest. So it's just a tax on the interest that is earned. So accordingly, we think it looks a lot like a gross receipts tax and is at least constitutionally suspect. Second, if you fix the constitutional problem and just apply the bill to Minnesota customers, it then needlessly penalizes Minnesota consumers with either higher interest rates or tighter credit conditions in the state. And since the current economic crisis is in part due to the problems in the credit markets, I think passing policies like this would just do further damage to the state's economy. Third, the 15% threshold is arbitrary, and as some of the discussion has already alluded to, it kind of ignores the realities of the marketplace. If you go back in time to November of 1979 to May of 1980, the prime interest rate was greater than 15%, and that's the rate given to the most creditworthy borrowers. So, more risky borrowers certainly should have a rate higher than that, and this bill would impose a tax on interest earned, even given to those most creditworthy borrowers at that time. I believe one of the maybe two of the issues that we addressed with Senator Ortman previously may have been addressed by the amendment. The kind of cumulative impact of interest collections, for example, on mortgages, I believe that has been addressed with references to the annual percentage rate, possibly even the impact on business-to-business transactions. I'm not positive of that yet. I'm still trying to get some information, having just seen the amendment recently. But if it does apply to business financing, there's some significant concerns with investment companies that provide mezzanine financing to various projects, construction and related projects in the state. And mezzanine financing is typically debt capital that gives investment companies the right to convert to an equity stake if the interest is not or the loan is not paid back at a certain period of time. And it's generally charged at a rate higher than 15% because of the risky nature of the products and the lack of collateral that's associated with the loans. So we would certainly have a concern if that is part of still part of this legislation. We would certainly have concerns about what it could do to construction and other business lending. Finally, one problem that occurred because of the amendment is including securitization of credit presents some issues as well. We think the pension funds and mutual funds that purchase securitized debt obligations will have to then track what portion of that security is from Minnesota, what portion do they have to withhold or pay tax at the end of the year. My guess is that the pension funds and the mutual funds that buy these instruments will probably not be very fond of this proposal, and it could dry up some of the purchases or the availability or just what investment companies buy for Minnesota pension investments. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk today. We also oppose Senate File 507 for philosophical reasons as well as for some technical reasons, and I do appreciate that the author has been working with us on some of our questions and some of our concerns, and I will continue to work with the author if this bill does go forward. The senator gave a very impassioned speech about financial institutions and lenders should pay, and they've profited from greed and all sorts of things like that. And I represent the Minnesota banks. I don't represent AIG. I don't represent Citigroup. I represent the Minnesota banks. And from the Minnesota banking industry's perspective, we're also not real happy about the way the financial services industry as a whole has been portrayed, and I share a lot of the bitterness that she has. When I hear comments, though, that a tax bill is designed to discourage reckless lending, my ears really perk up, and I wonder if this is the right committee to start looking at some of these issues. And we've already heard some very good questions and comments about the commerce aspects of this bill. I was very interested in the Hennepin County representative's discussion of what he's seeing as somebody who's serving process. While the focus is on lenders like AIG and the other problem institutions that have been reckless, the issues that he's seeing are gym memberships and cell phones. And they're related to job loss. They're not related to reckless lending. So I wonder if this is really the target of what we're trying to get at, or if there's something else that we're working on here. I am not a credit card expert. I think that's where banks would be most implicated in this. Minnesota doesn't really have any credit card issuers. A couple of my member banks do have credit card operations, but they're not located in Minnesota. Minnesota has taken a position of through its usury laws and its other business laws that have caused those types of operations to move out of state. The original intent for Minnesota to take that position was a protectionist type of an attitude. We wanted a certain level of lending in this state, and if it was higher than that, we didn't want it. Well, as it's turned out, of course, we all know that credit card lending still happens in Minnesota. It's just that the state doesn't get the benefit of having those jobs. And the other states that have those operations are getting the benefit of all those jobs that are not here. And I know we spent a lot of time this morning talking about job development and economic growth, and I think that's something that we should consider when we look at issues like this. I think there are some major concerns with Nexus. I don't know the extent to which an out-of-state credit card company is going to begin to pay this surtax here in Minnesota. I just don't know what the answer is to that question. I think it's a tough one. But I think the point that Mr. Hesse made, by the time you take that to the next step and you expect the purchaser of a security to track the Minnesota loans or lines of credit or credit card balances, and then to also track the ones that are over a certain percentage and then pay the tax on that, who are those purchasers? Again, it's the pension funds, it's cities and counties that purchase debt as a security, it's our 401ks. If my 401k has a portion of a security that was issued by one of these securitization companies, I own one millionth of a security that they buy. Am I, as the 401k owner, really supposed to track what percentage of that securitized debt is Minnesota debt that's over the 15%? I think that's unrealistic, and I think it's going to be an impossible thing to create a nexus from the purchaser of one of those securities back to the Minnesota borrower. I've got a couple technical issues that I would like to raise as well, some of the things that we've been talking about with the senator. The first one, on page 3 of the bill, where we look at the surtax rate. The surtax is on income attributable to interest earned. In the banking world and in the lender world, interest earned is very different from interest collected. That is something that we would definitely want to take a look at. Delinquency rates are really high right now on all sorts of loans, given the economic situation that we're in right now. We are earning a lot of interest that we're not necessarily collecting, and if you're taxing us on interest that we've earned but not collected, that's going to be a major problem. The second thing is the annual percentage rate definition that we're using, and this is a very technical thing and something that we'll continue to work on with the author. The annual percentage rate is the rate applied to the principal balance, and then it's annualized. Having the annual percentage rate that exceeds 15% on the principal balance is like having a fraction where you've got your numerator and your denominator, and then you've got a third denominator thrown in, and it just doesn't work. So we'd want to work with you on that as well. The third thing I'll note is that having this tax be retroactive to January 1 to loan decisions that we've already made is really a difficult situation, and I would hope that we would take a look at how we could make that situation, how we could change that situation. I don't know that a retroactive tax like this is something that we would want to do. And again, to the point about the securitizations, the Obama administration is doing everything they can to free up the credit markets. In order for us to get out of this economic cycle, we need the credit markets to function properly, pumping all sorts of money into it. And when you have a situation where securitization markets are going to be hampered like this bill would do, I think it really does some harm. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk on this bill. I think there are some major commerce implications. I know this is a tax committee, but I think there are some major commerce implications. If again the goal is to get at the reckless sort of lending that we were trying to get at, there are other ways around it rather than imposing a tax on an arbitrary number for an interest rate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schlander.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We have to respectfully oppose Senator Ortman's bill here today. Senator Ortman said earlier that she believes that the state should penalize lenders who intentionally price loans to account for a high rate of default. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know how else lenders are supposed to assess the price of their loans if we cannot account for the risk that's being taken and account for the high rate of default in certain classes of customers. When it comes to motor vehicles, many people who are forced to finance at higher rates are doing so really because they have to. You know, for whatever happened to result in a low credit score, you know, the fact remains that people need to drive a car. Approximately a third of the customers that finance through our dealerships are financing at a rate higher than 15%. That's a pretty good chunk of our customers. Largely, those are used car sales as well, I should just mention. The average dealership shops a customer seeking to finance with several lenders. So we are looking to find the best rates available for our customers. But in the past year, as everyone knows, you know, the credit market has dried up considerably, and even the lenders who specialize in lending to customers with poor credit, excuse me, you know, they have gotten very conservative. Dealers tell me that about a quarter of the customers that they were able to finance even last year, they're no longer able to find financing for. Even customers with credit scores as high as 650 could still be charged an interest rate over 15% on their used car loan today. So the credit market is really posing a problem for our ability to get people into motor vehicles. And I just want to say this. A car loan is a good way for someone with poor credit who's coming into the dealership, you know, as a result of a divorce or a medical problem or job loss or business failure or whatever has happened to decimate their credit score. An auto loan is a good way for them to improve their credit score. So we work with them, try to get them the best financing available. If they can, you know, make their payments on time and never be late and, you know, come in, trade it in, do it again, within, you know, 2 to 4 years, their credit has improved and they can move out of having to be in that, what they call a risk-based pricing with respect to the loan rate that they're able to get. People understand why they're being charged those higher rates and why their credit score is resulting in a higher rate. But, you know, for the most part, in our industry, they're grateful to get the loan because they need a car. And it is a way for them to be able to improve their score and improve that part of their financial life. In Minnesota, I should also mention the state has imposed upon us usury laws that cap how much motor vehicle loans can be, how much rate the motor vehicle loans can be charged. So for a new vehicle or a one-year-old vehicle, we can charge no more than 18%. For a 2 and 3 year old vehicle, we can charge 19.75%. And for older vehicles, 4 years old and older, we can charge 23.25%. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that the lenders that we work with take less profit because the state caps how much the rate can be. What often happens here is that the lenders will assess the risk of the customer based on their credit score and the vehicle that's being looked at. The lender's going to they're going to get their profit out of the deal. And what happens is that they usually are charging us acquisition fees for us to be able to sell off that loan paper. So contrary to all available evidence in the last year, our guys are really in it to make a profit. We need to make enough profit on the car to be able to sell the to be able to finance the customer into this vehicle. And if Wells Fargo is charging us an acquisition fee to be able to finance our customer, we still need to somehow figure out how to make that deal profitable. So the car's got to be priced right. If we've got to pay an additional 30% tax on that deal, that really cuts into profit. What happens, what's going to happen, is that just will mean that we are going to have to turn away more customers. I mean, that's what happens now if these numbers don't work out and, you know, the acquisition fees from the bank get too high. I mean, we just have to turn customers away, and that just leaves customers in a bad spot. That's where customers are going to turn to, you know, they're going to go buy the car from the guy that sells four cars a year at the gas station parking lot that's going to charge them $50 a month, never report it to the credit bureau, and the customer's in a bad spot. I mean, the customer's not getting a good deal. They're not getting a good car. They're not in any position to improve their own credit rating. And it's just, you know, I mean, we really do have to look at how this is going to affect the people who can least afford to be sort of squeezed out of the market at this point. And in addition, I'll just echo some of the concerns that my colleagues had made about, we're not even really sure. I apologize to the author. I didn't get a chance to really review the amendment, so I don't really understand how the amendment works and what's in it. But based on the bill, we're not really sure when or how we collect the tax. And if we initiate the loan at over 15%, do we pay the 30% on that chunk? What if we only keep a half a percent and then we sell the loan paper, you know, to the bank? Or what, you know, what happens in the case where we don't even keep the interest rate on the loan, but we have to actually pay Wells Fargo to get rid of the paper at an acquisition fee? I'm just the question about the accrued interest rate that could happen on and customers with even the best credit in a very typical loan to have the interest rate. I brought the actual contract that you sign when you sign up for an installment sales contract. Your APR is listed, of course, and your finance charge is listed. That's the total amount of interest that we collect on the loan. So if that total amount of interest exceeds 15%, and I understand that that's maybe not Senator Ortman's intention with this bill, but that's certainly how that section looks in the bill, that it would be very easy for on a car loan for you to pay more than 15% of the principal balance as you pay your car loan. And that would apply to even customers with excellent credit in getting a loan rate well below 15%. I ran the numbers on a customer who took out a $25,000 loan, had a 6.5% APR over a 6-year term or a 5-year term. And over the course of that loan, that would very easily fall into triggering this 30% tax. You know, again, what about the customer that pays off their loan early, that we don't end up earning the interest we thought we would earn at the origination of the loan? What about situations where the vehicle is repossessed, when the customer defaults? Mr. Chair, members, we have very serious concerns about how this will impact our ability not only to, you know, extend credit to customers, but to structure their loans in a way where they want the month or they can get the monthly payment that they want that will allow them to have a reliable vehicle. Most of all, Mr. Chair, we're concerned about just our ability to keep customers and service customers and not have to turn them away. So I'll end my comments.
Ms. Schlander, can I give you a little homework assignment?
Sure.
I've asked the chamber to do this. If not this, what might the auto dealers be willing to support in a proposal to help balance the state's budget deficit? You know, we all got to figure this out before May, and I have no appetite for doing the governor's appropriation bond, from borrowing money for the next 20 years, draw it forward to balance this budget. That's $1 billion. Now, if we're not going to do that, we all got to figure out some way to raise $1 billion, even if we're going to do the governor's budget. So if you could think about that.
Sure.
I've had some discussions with the chamber about that. I think we all need to be part of this solution. So I appreciate it if you gave that some thought. You don't
Mr.
have
Chair.
To say it publicly. You can just come by and whisper in my ear.
I will be happy to do
that.
What
might be something acceptable to you.
Okay.
Is there confidentiality on that?
Senator Pogomel, Russ Rangers, we can talk to each other like that. Ms. Shalander grew up in Nashwauk, Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
We got like 1 minute each.
No, we don't.
Mr. Chair.
Our time's getting pretty short.
However,
Senator Ortman.
Before we take too much more testimony, I would like to make a couple of quick comments in response to what was just said. First of all, there's no intention here to penalize anybody or to target anybody. There's no reason why any business has to make a loan. They can always say no. People can save more. There's no reason. I mean, we want to accommodate people, and we don't want to shut people out of the market. And so there's no limitation on any interest rate in this bill. Any interest rate may be charged. About the Chamber of Commerce comment, if I could, Mr. Chair, they talk about the mezzanine financing, the business-to-business financing, that will be impacted by this tax. Well, they say in their own documents that these loans are created with little due diligence. They aren't properly collateralized. They don't check to make sure that there's a payment back. And this applies to all of these loans, that when there is this high risk of default, that means that there's more of a risk of a burden on the state of Minnesota when somebody defaults. And right now, the lenders are not paying for those costs. And I hope that when you listen to additional testimony against that, that you'll consider that.
Mr. Anderson, Mr. Hickey, I see you around this building all the time. And this bill was publicly posted for a hearing last week. And I'm going to give you a little bit of discretion today, but nobody called and asked to be put on the agenda other than the people we have listed. And we're not going to start going down the road to open the committee hearing up to anybody who wants to come up and testify. The point of putting out the public notice is so that people have an opportunity to come and sign up so they can be recognized to testify. I'm going to give you a little discretion this one time, but I know you two guys know the deal. And, Buzz, I appreciate you coming and telling Julie today that you wanted to testify on this. But we have to be, going forward, I think, a little more respectful of the process. I mean, we have an agenda here that we need to get through, and we just can't on bills allow too much outside of what people have signed up for. So with that, Mr. Hickey.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. And sorry I didn't get a hold of you earlier. I'm getting lost in everything that's going around this building lately. But Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And just wanted to make one brief comment about a concern and perspective from a small retailer. And aside from our small banks and auto dealers and real estate brokers who are obviously strongly against this bill, I did talk to a couple of our retailers, and they still do extend credit. And I wasn't aware of that. It's not the old-fashioned scenario where rural retailers used to do it, especially in rural Minnesota. But they do still extend credit to local governments and to other businesses. And they're charging an interest rate of 1.5% per month. I haven't seen the amendment, so I don't know if how that's going to work out when somebody sometimes pays their bill off after a month and sometimes doesn't, and it starts to accumulate. And maybe it's more convenient for that local government or that contractor or that other business to want to delay this to the end of the year due to their financial situation. So I don't know if you actually get to 18% if that triggers the 15% trigger in this bill, but that's a big concern. Our member thought that this could really dry up local credit for local governments and small businesses who really rely on this from retailers. And hardware stores especially and others are doing a lot of this, and I was surprised to learn that, and so that is something that could really be negatively impacted by the bill, and I appreciate the chance to make a brief comment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your indulgence and that of the committees, and I apologize for not signing up sooner. I really do sincerely apologize. Thanks for the opportunity to speak for just a minute, and I will condense my remarks. Consumers are very accustomed to credit, and they take advantage of it in many different ways. oftentimes the ways that you see it are through retail stores like the JCPenney card or the Sears card or the Best Buy card or the Herberger's card. These cards that many people probably have in their pockets are not cards that are owned by the companies, even though their name may be on it. The card is actually owned by GE Capital, Citibank, or other financing agencies. Now, I've talked to these agencies, and they said, you know, they're going to abide by Minnesota law. If you raise the tax, they're going to pay the tax, except they really aren't going to pay the tax. What's going to happen is it's going to be passed on to the consumer as a line item fee on the loan, on the card, or the transaction. It'll also be paid by it'll also be paid by the consumer in higher costs. So you're going to see a higher cost for the TVs, the boats, the jet skis, the stoves, the appliances that you finance. It's going to get built into the cost. Now, these agencies also provide financing through other means. You can go into a furniture store. You can go into an electronics store. You can go into an outdoor sports dealer. And you can apply for credit on the spot. You apply for the credit. They run the background check. The credit agency gives approval, and the loan is granted to the consumer. Again, it's not offered by the dealer. It's offered by GE Capital, or it's offered by Citibank or some other financing agency. Customers have choices. They can go to a bank and get a fixed rate loan instead. They can pay with cash. They can finance it through an unsecured loan, which is essentially what happens when you finance through GE Capital or one of these other agencies. They can get it at the spot. They can sign up. They can take the product home with them. They can also refuse to buy. Let me tell you also what finance agencies have told me. They're going to recover their costs one way or another. And if they're not able to do so, they're not going to offer the credit. Now, if you think they're afraid to leave Minnesota's credit market, well, a number are already leaving the Minnesota credit market. Testron has already pulled its financing, its wholesale financing for Articat. Citibank has already pulled its retail customer financing to Articat dealers. And in addition to that, another company called Testron has already, and GE Capital, have raised their financing costs 2% to people who buy other kinds of things like Manitou pontoons. So if you think they're afraid to pull credit, they will pull credit, and you'll have less opportunities for consumers to buy things that they want. I would urge you to vote no, and I would say that respectfully. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Pat Martin, and I have the pleasure of representing a number of different financial services entities, trade associations, and the like. You've united those organizations by virtue of hearing this bill today. Those organizations oppose this bill, and I can detail those organizations, but I think that you would probably better be served if I told you one 30-second story, and that is the Chapter 53 and 56 lenders that are now included in the bill by virtue of the amendment, and I apologize, I didn't see the amendment until just 20 minutes ago. But when I see the Chapter 53 and 56 lenders in there, please understand that those folks have been licensed and regulated and examined in the state of Minnesota for 70 years or so. And those organizations make loans to people like this. There would be a person that has a contracting business. They want a skidder or a backhoe. They need to rent it. It's $1,000. They come in, ask one of the Minnesota-based lenders if they can have $1,000. Now, that interest rate might be 15%. It might be 18%. But whatever, it's worth it to them so that they can get that piece of equipment to do the job. By the way, I appreciate your conversation about the rates, especially on that individual that had that pack of gum. By the way, it was T-Berry, and it was purchased at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Yep, I'm that person.
Oh, was it you?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's a small world, Senator Shire.
Mr. Chairman, that's a long time ago. I heard that.
It has been a long time ago. And as a matter of fact, the Chapter 53 and 56 lenders, as I mentioned, have been doing business for 70 years. I don't think they've appeared in front of the legislature for decades. But that's the problem with this bill, and so we respectfully oppose it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, T. Berry is
Senator Ortman, last word.
Yep. T. Berry is my favorite gum, too. I just want to put perspective on that this bill. If I borrowed or you borrowed $1,000 from any lender, they could borrow that money from the Federal Reserve on the open market at 0.25%. As I said, the Federal Reserve amount now is 0.13, but I've calculated it to 0.25. They would charge 15%, and I would pay $150. They would earn 6,000% rate of return. They would earn back the carrying cost for that money, the money that they would borrow, the cost of the loan, in the first payment. The bank never loses money. Out of the $150 is the $2.50 for the Federal Reserve rate. They make $147.50 in clean profit. There was no risk because it was never even their money. If you borrowed the same $1,000 at a 30% interest rate, the bank again pays the same $2.50 carrying cost, and they earn $297.50 on that loan. The first 15% is unaffected. The 30% tax over the 15% would amount to $45. $45 to the state of Minnesota, the bank would earn $252.50. If you paid off the loan over 5 years, which some people do, they extend them out for quite some time, that same 30%, the bank would earn $1,500 in interest at that same carrying cost of $2.50 per year. The bank would earn $1,487.50, and the state would earn $225 in tax. Members, I know we're going to have a philosophical difference with some of the members in the lending institutions and retailers, but we have to have the courage to address this problem in the state of Minnesota. Apparently, they're not going to address it in Washington. We have a lending problem, a borrowing problem in the state of Minnesota and across our country, and we can begin to address it here. We have an almost catastrophic budget deficit. And these lenders have participated in creating the economic environment that we're in right now and should participate in the solution in meeting some of the needs of Minnesotans over the next few bienniums. This bill will raise $215 million towards solving our budget gap in the next biennium. We can work on some of the language. I think we want to make sure that we're charging only on what's collected. I think it's pretty easy to confuse this issue, and I've learned after 7 years that that's a pretty good tactic. If you can't think of anything else and you just disagree with the bill, you can just try to confuse the issue. I hope we'll get past this and work on this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shedd.
Mr. Chairman, I would take issue with some of the math. The math on the clock tells me we don't have time to do that, and I didn't write down all the figures, but the first example I don't think was accurate. I wanted to ask a question, and I don't know if someone from the department can answer. Maybe you know, Mr. Chairman, do companies like Chase and Citigroup, do they pay any portion of tax to the state of Minnesota for business? I mean, do we have the nexus to collect tax from them based on the income they earn from their business in Minnesota?
I see Dr. Wilson is here, and I'll bet if he doesn't know, somebody that works for him does.
My name is Steve Frankel. I'm at Legal Services Department of Revenue. There is nexus asserted over corporations that do business in the state premised on an economic presence in the state for corporate franchise tax. It's a different standard for gross receipts or sales tax. But there would be a corporate franchise tax that could be imposed on a corporation that is systematically engaged in the market in Minnesota based on their net income that they derive from Minnesota on an apportioned basis.
So the answer is they do pay corporate income taxes.
I don't know about the particular corporations that she was referring to, but if they're engaged in business here, yes, they can.
So, Mr. Chairman, it would be like Discover and Chase and Citigroup and
I would assume so, yes.
Card banks.
I don't have any taxpayer information on that, but my assumption based on the law would be that they would.
Okay.
Well, and so. Mr. Chair, even though they're out of state, they absolutely track how much they earn here because they send a bill every month, and they know exactly how much they collect in tax. There's no apportionment concern here, and there's really no difficulty in discerning how much would be owed to Minnesota tax if this were implemented.
Well, the Quill decision was over the collection of sales tax.
Correct. This is not a sales tax, no, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify. I mean, I was sure that they did pay some kind of apportioned, corporate franchise tax to Minnesota for that. So it's not as if they're not paying taxes. I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for credit card companies, the banks that issue them, and the kinds of things that are happening to people right now. But I'm afraid, Senator Ortman, in your bill, is going to actually deny credit or the ability to charge something for people who may need it most, who may need to get that refrigerator, who may need to get a new used car, if you will, that I don't want them not to be able to do that or to have it cost more. And the people who can afford to pay their credit card bill every month, they're not going to be affected by this. So my concern would be for the people who can't, and I think that's, a lot of Minnesotans.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I share that concern. I don't want to make things out of reach for Minnesotans, especially if they have a need. Say they've just gotten a job and they don't have the cash they need to get the car or something like that. I am very concerned about that as well. I hope that this tax doesn't get passed along to the consumers. It should not be passed along to the consumers because we've talked about the profits. I don't know that we can control that, but I will try to look to see if there is some way, as in with the payday lenders, we know they cannot pass it along because there's a cap on the interest rate that they can charge. And so I'll follow through on that and see if there's some way we can do that. The other way, perhaps, is to charge, to include monthly fees and late fees and things like that into this. That may also, or to cap those types of things. Again, I don't want to run afoul of regulating commerce, but there may be some additional ways with the help of counsel and with the Department of Revenue to discourage or disincent the companies from passing along those interest rate taxes.
Senator Schatz.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be great if we would just say you can't pass the taxes you pay along to the consumer, but I think that's impossible. I mean, we know that those taxes are passed, which is why some of us support reducing the corporate franchise tax over time. And, we know that those things get passed on. So, Senator Ortman, I just don't think you accomplished that. Mr. Chairman, I'll be quiet.
Senator Marty, then we have to move on.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was going to say, with some of them, like with the predatory lenders, they are capped and this would hit them. They could not pass it on. But I think there's a very creative approach. It may need some more work and whether the 15% is the right number and so on. But I guess I like it that you're trying to look at new ways to address this issue, and I think it is an important consumer issue to look at. So.
Chair leaves over Senate File 507 as amended for possible inclusion in the committee bill. Thank you, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator members.
Waiting for us upstairs, or are they just? Oh, good. So we're not the only ones.
I know.
Yeah, well, it must be a good idea.
This reminds me, I have a resolution to get out of to have the two of them supporting.
Senator Rest, Senate File 1708.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1708 is a resolution memorializing the members of the Minnesota Congressional delegation to sponsor and support the so-called Main Street Fairness Act. It is a bill that is soon to be introduced in Congress that would, in a sense, overturn the Belisess case going all the way back to 1967 and the 1992 Quill Supreme Court decisions that denied states the ability and authority and put on hold essentially a moratorium on the collection of sales and use tax by by out-of-state sellers. And in the last 10 years, what that has spurred is a group of states, now numbering 23, that have joined what's called the streamlined sales tax. Organization of states and Minnesota became a member in 1999 to organize the administration of the sales tax system so that they are consistent among the states, particularly in the definition of items. It has nothing to do with the rate that's charged or even what things are charged, but just that the definitions would be consistent across states and in that way to present to Congress a united front. Legislation at the federal level has been tried before. This is about this is soon to be introduced, and it's about the farthest that we have gotten. I've served on the National Conference of State Legislatures Executive Committee's Task Force on State and Local Taxation of Communications and Electronic Commerce. It's a real long title, but it's a very close-knit group for the last 8 or 9 years as we have supported our State Departments of Revenue as they meet with the Streamlined Sales Tax Group to work out all the complexities of the streamlining that, again, that administration. Streamlined sales tax provisions are supported by the Minnesota Retailers Association, among others, and the task force and the executive committee of NCSL have asked the member states, the streamlined sales tax member states, to pass resolutions like this and send it on to their congressional delegations. I think it is a usually I think these resolutions are of no import, but this is a very timely one during this congressional session, and I would appreciate the support and being able to move this bill onto the floor and vote on it and send it to our the resolution to our congressional delegation.
Any discussion, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Murray.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest is one who thinks that the streamlined sales tax changes we've been trying to make to do that have not always been good policy. I think the cause of the streamlined sales tax in order to get us this to make happen, I think, is worth doing. And so I very, very much hope Congress does act, because it's frustrating to make choices that we may not think are wise in order to fit in with the streamlined sales tax. So I guess I hope it happens soon. I'm just curious, though, why we haven't heard from more Main Street businesses in Minnesota who are getting penalized unfairly. I mean, I picture they'd be up in arms, and Mr. Hickey and others would be up in arms saying, look, you know, it's unfair competition.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when we had the legislation that joined Minnesota to the streamlined sales tax group, we did have a lot of discussion and interest from the so-called Main Street businesses, the retailers who have their businesses in Minnesota. And we have had streamlined issues that have come up over time. I don't recall any particularly in the last couple of years, but we did have lots of discussion about what constitutes candy as opposed to a cookie in terms of being taxed. What about delicatessen sales as opposed to buying a meat that's packaged in a grocery store, et cetera? And we have settled those issues. So there's been ongoing participation by Minnesota, the Department of Revenue, I believe, and in particular since Streamline started. And just to point out, the latest I have is from 2004, the estimates of total revenues that are lost because of e-commerce is $456 million a year in Minnesota.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, one last thing, and that my only point is I'm surprised that the businesses that are paying sales tax here and seeing their competition not be taxed, I'm just surprised they're not much more vocal about this both here and in Washington.
And I would just say I think their support has just been ongoing and steady and rather than loud about that, which is not a bad thing, Senator.
Sure, I'm not complaining. I'm just surprised.
What's the number?
1708.
May I make a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1708 be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I had a resolution that had to go to rules. I mean, I guess if you send it to the floor, I think they'll automatically just send it to rules. I think they do go there. Mine had to. It's there now, and I'm assuming that I'll get it out.
Senator Rest, do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't think resolutions like this had to go to rules. I mean, I've had a number of resolutions. Maybe it does. Resolutions that are, you know, congratulatory and that, and they go directly to rules, and they don't go to a policy committee or a finance committee at all. Was yours one like that, or Senator Bach? It doesn't matter.
Senator Rest, why don't we just lay it over for now? We're going to hear a couple more bills,
okay,
and we'll bring it
out.
Back up. Council's going to check and see if it
okay.
needs to go to
That'd
rules.
That'd be great.
Or
either way, it's fine. Then I'm Thank
so
you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll temporarily lay over Senate File 1708.
Okay.
Senate File 913. Members, Senate File 913 is a bill that I've been working on. It's a land use planning bill, and we've been trying to work with the cities and the townships on that. It's here, and we're still working on all the language in the bill, but the provision that I'd like to talk about today is the idea of a new kind of TIF district called a compact development district. It's if you look at the bill, it's on page 7, lines 7.11 through 7.20. This is a 25-year TIF district, same kind of conditions as a redevelopment district. Mr. Flaherty, can you come up and kind of speak to the provisions of the new TIF?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my name is Tim Flaherty, and I'm representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And I'll just make a couple comments and then turn it over to Steve Peterson, who will discuss the TIF provisions. This provision was really developed to implement one of the recommendations of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group from last session. And the whole point of their recommendations was to have more compact development so that the state could meet its CO2 reduction goals. So as part of that, implementing their recommendations, we included in this bill something that would do that. Their specific recommendation was to provide incentives and technical assistance to communities to target growth in priority areas, and those priority areas our planned growth areas in cities. So with that, I'll ask Steve Peterson to describe the TIF provision in the bill.
Chairman, members, my name is Steve Peterson with Flaherty and Hood here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. This TIF provision was designed under the idea that there is a natural problem when you're trying to do a redevelopment that you have a building already there in many cases. And the idea was to say that if you have a willing area where people want to put a development in, and you say you want to put up a three-story building and your choices are in an already developed area for sale that already has, say, a one-story building or a greenfield, it's always cheaper to go to the greenfield than to knock down that building and demolish it and then rebuild a taller building. This TIF district would then allow communities to pay for the demolition of a building, removal of it, so that they can put in a building that is at least three times as large as the current one. This is strictly for commercial and industrial use. It also allows the TIF district to have the TIF increment to be used for non-motorized vehicle improvements. So if you want to put in a bike path or a bike locker room or something like that, it would also be included in that TIF district.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm not real big on TIF districts, but since we are doing them, this is a good cause for it.
Yeah. I agree, Senator Marty. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard it said that this was just for commercial industrial. Could it be construed to also be available for mixed use where you wrap in commercial, industrial, and residential and other services?
Senator Dibble, Chairman, the bill is written that it's primarily commercial and industrial use. I believe that it has to be the current parcels have to be 70% of commercial industrial, but I believe that the language actually states that it has to be the building that is built has to be all commercial industrial. We limited it to that, but we are open to making that more of a mixed use.
Senator Dibble, I think that's maybe a good conversation for the conference committee. Mm-hmm. This does create incentive to do more compact development. It's pretty, you could almost call it a green TIF maybe, but it's Senator Dibble.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it is, it's ripe with all kinds of opportunities. It's not too far off of some of what we talked about with my bill and Senator Moore's bill and creating the transit-oriented development-type districts. The focus of those, of course, is mixed use. You've got your commercial, industrial, your jobs, and your housing all kind of in proximity. So I like it. I think it's great.
Anything else, members? No, the rest of the body of the bill is land use things, and we're trying to keep the cities and townships at the table. So when I lay this over, I don't want anybody to think we're going to roll this bill into the tax bill. I do want to do the TIF provision, and then we'll, as we work together with the House, we'll try to figure out what to tweak it to make it work, hoping they'll be willing to accept it. But the other provisions relative to land use, we're going to try and work out some agreement with the township, between the townships and the cities on that. And I think, having the bill will still be in the committee, and we'll at a minimum, we're going to take the TIF provisions out of it, include it in the omnibus bill. And if we can find some agreement later on the land use part of this, we'll incorporate them and move it out, or maybe discuss them in the conference committee if we can find some agreement on making a little more headway on a little smarter land use planning. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
This may have been noted. Could the witnesses once again define a Class 3 property if they haven't already?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, the Class 3, I believe, is all the commercial and industrial types.
Okay.
And staff can correct me if I'm wrong.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question about Section 3. Wondering if we shouldn't have just a little bit of discussion about that provision, the incorporations prohibited after June 1st of 2009.
Incorporations of new cities inflict cost on this committee because they create new local government obligations, local government aid obligations. So I am interested and would like to have a discussion with the townships, I think, before. I'd like to incorporate that prohibition in, at least for some period of time, maybe not indefinitely, but for some period of time until we can get some agreement on what smarter growth might look like. So we'll try to have that discussion with the townships and see if we can include something relative to that in addition to the TIF provisions. Senator Squay?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I believe earlier this session we did have a issue that came up of a township that had a number of communities in it and some of the difficulties that they were experiencing. So I just wanted to highlight that provision to the members that I have an interest in that also.
Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sedgwick.
On the compact development district, as I read it, I'm trying to understand and probably for the witnesses here, why do we need this in addition to TIF? Could not TIF do this in and of itself, as we know that law?
Senator
Peterson,
Mr. Chairman, the idea of this TIF was to specify the current redevelopment laws is slightly different, and this is basically stating that if you have any parcel in a developed area already, and you feel that this parcel should be developed to a higher level of density, you want a larger building, that as long as you're making it three times larger, you can use that TIF money to pay for the demolition of that building, basically making it completely fair with the current greenfield out in the edge of town. So that's the point of this compact development TIF district. I don't believe the current TIF language would allow you to do that as easily.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I like your bill, the whole bill. You can do whatever you want. You can roll it into the tax bill if you want. And apparently, I need to take some lessons from you, because the city's did a nice job of stopping my bill dead in its tracks, and I see your bill keeps moving. So I need to figure out
method here. Charlie's over Senate File 913.
Not this city. You guys have been great.
I wanted possible consideration. And Senator Ress, Senate File 1708 does need to go to the Rules Committee. So
that's correct. So I move that Senate File 1708.
Chair takes Senate File 1708 off the table. Mm-hmm. Senator Ress moves Senate File 1708 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
1708 is passed.
Mr. Chairman.
Members are calling for us on the floor. So, Mr. Barrett, sorry. They had recessed for a bit for the Finance Committee, and
they won't.
So we'll have to, Mr. Barrett and the people interested in the
charitable
Senate File 1158 and Senate File 282, we will have to take up on Monday morning. Members, we're going to meet Monday morning. We had tentatively posted 10 o'clock. We may have to do that a little earlier now that we know we have a couple of additional bills to consider. So we might try 9 or 9:30. So we'll get a notice out on that. Committee adjourned.